Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff. This week on the show, we are going to be livening up
the world with this wonderful podcast and living it up here in my basement.
I was going to say living up to our name of the Weekly Stuff. We're just going to talk about stuff this week.
Yeah.
That some happened this week, some didn't. You know?
Yeah, it's going to be the fun. Stupid stuff again.
The stupid stuff again, yeah.
Lots of non-stupid, like, non-trivial things happened. That's not this podcast, though.
This was a shitty week, Sean.
Every week is a shitty week.
And I have a lot of... One thing we're going to be talking about today is just a lot of video games we've been playing.
Yeah.
Some new, some old.
Yeah.
And I think... Tell me if you feel the same way, Sean. I've been playing a lot of video games this week because it's like, I cannot look at the real world right now.
Uh-huh.
You know, I need to go... play a game about, you know, Mario hanging out with some rabbits because there ain't any Supreme Court justices in that game.
Yeah, or I need to just go live out this nice fantasy of living by the edge of your teeth in a world where humanity is on the decline and everyone's dying and
see, that
you have
feels...
to scramble for resources, which is a hopeful future compared to the one we're currently looking at.
Okay.
There might still be giraffes in that one.
Yes, that's true. Very true. If you can't tell, one of the things we're going to be talking about today is Sean and I have both... without discussing it, randomly started playing The Last of Us again.
I mean, not entirely randomly, but yes. But like independently started playing The Last of Us from the same starting point of, yo, that Last of Us 2 demo is really good, and it's been 5 years since The Last of Us came out.
Yeah.
I should probably play The Last of Us again.
Exactly. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. Preview, I think, a bigger topic we're going to be doing on that game later on, because this is the 5-year anniversary of that game.
Yeah.
Sean, we are now officially at the point where we can do 5-year anniversaries of games we covered on this podcast.
Yeah, it's a bad feeling.
Yeah. But first, we're going to go over a bunch of news. Again, stupid news. Movie, TV, video game stuff, not... children in cages news, you know, stupid news that we can laugh at. And we're just going to have fun with that, and then we're going to talk some stuff, we're going to shoot the shit, and it'll be that kind of episode.
Yeah.
I like doing these every once in a while.
It's a good, just like, unpack stuff episode.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, so let's unpack our baggage, Sean.
Okay.
You want to start with some news?
Okay, what's going on in the world of news, Jonathan?
Stupid news again, asterisk. Let's start with, this is a cool piece of stupid news, which is that Doctor Who, our favorite show, got its new composer.
Yeah.
Have you heard about this, Sean?
Yes, yes.
Yes, Segun Akinola, an alumni of the Royal Birmingham Conservatoire, which is just very fancy, who has also worked with the BBC a lot on a lot of different BBC productions, is the new composer for Doctor Who. He has been commissioned for Series 11, and I would assume to stay in that role for a while.
Yeah.
His predecessor, Murray Gold, of course, did it for like 15 years.
Uh-huh.
So maybe don't want to expect that of any particular person, because that's a crazy long assignment. But yes, Doctor Who gets its first new composer in our adulthoods.
I mean, in this, like, incarnation of the show,
yes.
You know, since it came back in 2005, it was Murray Gold all the way through.
Yep.
And so, yeah, it'll be interesting seeing someone else take a swing at it, see if they can live up to Murray Gold or Dudley Simpson.
Exactly. So, yeah, like, not a ton of news here. You know, I did not know a lot of his credits, but I actually kind of like that. He's very much in the position Murray Gold was in back in 2005.
Right.
Where he's, like, a BBC guy... you know, very well qualified in terms of, like, education and musical background and everything, coming into Doctor Who fresh. And that's great. It also is a nice reminder just that, like, Doctor Who is totally regenerating this time. Like, every cell in the show's body, like, nobody who's worked on the show recently is working on it this year.
Uh-huh.
It's sort of crazy. But also exciting, don't you think?
Yes, I mean, it's what the show needs, you know. Every once in a while it just needs to flesh everything out and be like, fuck it. Let's start fresh.
Yep. So this is cool. Glad to welcome another new name, fresh face, into the Doctor Who family.
Yep.
And I'm excited to hear his music. Because they also pointedly said, we'll be delivering a fresh new take on the Doctor Who theme. And just reminded me, I love it when we get new Doctor Who themes.
I hope that this guy really likes the middle eight in the Doctor Who theme, because it has been unloved in recent Doctor Who history.
It has. Murray Gold tried to bring it back in the end credits for a while, but then the end credits got too short, and he couldn't use it.
I want to bring back either the way that the first Doctor era did it, where it like kind of starts going to middle eight and then trails off, which is very cool and ominous, or just go full Seventh Doctor and just put it right there in the opening theme.
I think it would be good, because again, we've had, like, Murray Gold did a lot of different versions of it, of the main theme, over his tenure, but none of the openings had the middle eight, so that would be a good way to, like, differentiate it.
Yes.
But we'll find out. You know, we're gonna go to the Doctor Who premiere with signs that say, bring back the middle eight.
Yes.
Yeah. No. Anyway.
Which sounds way more like serious than it actually is. Like, the middle eight sounds like a code for some sort of political scandal.
Yes. All right. So, Sean, let's talk some movie news now.
Okay.
First off, most of this is stuff we're going to be making fun of.
Uh-huh.
If you haven't noticed the pattern on this show, we tend to just pick movie news because this is the thing we've talked about before. Like, video games, you don't hear about unless they are happening, right?
Uh-huh. Yes, yeah.
Movies, stupid shit gets announced all the time. And especially in, like, our clickbait era, you hear about it and then it's like, let's tear this apart.
Yeah, it feels like somebody's, like, assistant that got a coffee heard it from somebody that heard it from someone that was in the room that somebody mentioned the idea of making, like, a fucking Boba Fett movie or something. That's how you hear about it.
Right.
Like, the Boba Fett movie specifically was more founded than that.
Yes.
But there are a lot of these movies that's like, and so we decided to make a, like, The Giving Tree film. It's like, what? That nobody ever said that. What do you mean?
All right. This is actually official news, but let's start with this. Indiana Jones 5, which has been planned since Disney bought Lucasfilm. Easy to forget that, because if you think Lucasfilm Star Wars,
yeah.
Lucasfilm is also Indiana Jones, technically, so we could have the Disney logo on Indiana Jones. But it was supposed to come out, I think, at one point in 2019. It was then delayed to 2020. It has now been delayed past 2020 with no date at all. Jonathan Kasdan, the son of Lawrence Kasdan, who wrote the original Raiders of the Lost Ark, recently co-wrote Han Solo with his father, has been brought on to rewrite the David Koepp script. David Koepp wrote Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. He's written some good things, too, like the first Spider-Man, but there you go. But here's a stat that I looked up because I was so fascinated with this. In July of 2021, which is the earliest date this movie could now come out, because they've said, they were going to have it to July 2020. It's delayed. I don't think it'll come out before July 2021. Harrison Ford would be 79 years old. Steven Spielberg would be 75. Okay?
Yeah.
So let's just keep that in mind. That, like, by the time this movie comes out, Harrison Ford will either be at or approaching 80 years old. Kind of, this is a question you also have about, like, I don't know, politicians at a certain point.
Uh-huh.
Do we want them to be that old?
But, like, at least a lot of a politician's job is sitting down and, like, writing things and talking about shit.
Yes.
If you're the dude playing Indiana Jones, obviously they have stuntmen and everything, but still,
yes.
Like, it is an active film role. And it's just like, don't kill Harrison Ford, please. Like, please don't do that.
Yeah, I mean,
don't kill him.
On one level, Harrison Ford dying on the set of an Indiana Jones movie does sort of feel like how the stars would align to kill Harrison Ford. Like, that feels like how his biography
sure.
in some ways should end. But on the other hand,
don't kill Harrison Ford.
You almost did it on Star Wars The Force Awakens.
Exactly.
Forget this. It wasn't a stunt. He was walking out of the Millennium Falcon, the door malfunctioned, and it crushed his leg. Poor dude got his leg crushed on a fucking Star Wars movie. Just, it wasn't a stunt walking down the ramp.
Yeah,
so
and now you're asking him to play Indiana Jones, who's far more of an action character than even Han Solo is.
It's yeah, like, unless you're doing this as like a My Dinner with Andre, like, homage where Indiana Jones is sitting down with like someone else who's an archaeologist and they just talk for 90 minutes about their adventures. I don't know. I think it's just going to be sad at a certain point, Sean.
Yeah. And because, that's all outside of just, also don't make another Indiana Jones movie,
yes.
regardless of the age of the people participating.
Yeah, I mean, let me put it this way. Harrison Ford and Steven Spielberg, they're approaching 80. I hate to be morbid, people do die in
uh-huh.
this world. And I just don't know if I want to see either of them wasting their twilight years on this.
Yeah.
You know, like Harrison Ford kind of, you know, he does what he wants to do and it sort of depends. But, like, Spielberg is still an active filmmaker, but he also is 75. He only has so many films left in him because of just nature, you
yeah.
know? And I just don't, I don't need one of those to be Indiana Jones 5. I
yeah.
really don't. He's done it. He's proven everything. That's the part of it, is that there's no, like, hunger left in Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
I feel like you could get a great script together and direct the hell out of it, and it would still, there's none of that hunger in it that would animate that kind of story. So I just, I don't understand the impetus for this. I don't really get why Harrison Ford and Spielberg are, like, as invested in it as they seem to be, that they are attached.
Yeah.
I really don't understand the point of this. And, you know, I think what would be funny is if Disney just decided to do young Indiana Jones and just cast Alden Ehrenreich for it again and just went with it.
Yeah, and don't market it at all and put it out on a weekend that historically does poor for them.
Yes.
And just, like, do things and then put Darth Maul in at the end. It's a yes. surprise.
Yeah, but I don't know. You know, Steven Spielberg is currently working on a movie I find more exciting for him, which is a remake of West Side Story.
Okay, yeah.
West Side Story is one of the greatest musicals ever, but it is also, I think, sort of undeniably dated for people now.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
There are no Puerto Rican people in it. It's white people in brownface.
Yeah.
And, you know, have your debates about that if you want. I think in the time, I don't think it necessarily mars the movie, but you look at it now, and it's certainly, if you are like 25 like us, it is kind of hard to watch parts of the movie because of that. And there have been updates to the music and everything that have made it more modern and authentic. And, you know, Spielberg is casting, like, unknowns. And that sounds like a cool idea.
Yes.
Again, I want him to do something like that that sounds like there's meat on those bones. I don't know if there's meat on the Indiana Jones bone. And we don't even really hate Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
No, yeah, we're pushing that movie.
No.
I like that movie fine.
It's
I haven't seen it since we saw it together in the theater.
Yeah.
I have, like, no need to go watch that film again, but...
The movie that is, Sean, 10 years old this year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, that's the thing. This would be Indiana Jones 5 15 years after Indiana Jones 4, which already felt like it was the 20-year later, which was the 20-year later sequel to Indiana Jones 3. So, it's just so silly. They should just not do this. That is one franchise that makes very little sense to me. Because I like most of the Indiana Jones movies, but it is not Star Wars. You cannot do it forever. It's the Harrison Ford show, like that, and the Spielberg show.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing, is you can't really do it without them.
Uh-huh.
So maybe just let it rest. You know, do a re-release. Put the movies back out there and let us, well, I don't know, something like that. That'd be more fun.
And just please don't kill Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
I can't stress it enough. Bring back the middle eight. Don't kill Harrison Ford. Those are the messages we take away from today's podcast.
Yes, exactly. All right, Sean, let's go with a really stupid piece of news.
Okay.
Because this, believe it or not, is official. This sounds like an Onion headline. This is actual news.
No.
Jared Leto has been cast as Morbius the Living Vampire in Morbius, another spin-off of the Spider-Man franchise in the same vein as Venom for Sony Pictures, scheduled to come out next year. And I stress again, that is not an Onion headline.
No.
That movie is never happening.
No. Like, I really need the book that just tells, like, the tell-all story of the, like, second attempt at Spider-Man from Sony. Because I thought that was dead, like, 2 years ago or whatever. And then Spider-Man Homecoming comes out. It's like, okay, Marvel has Spider-Man again. It's over. Your weird, the weird Sony ambitions of making the Spider-Man expanded universe that, for listeners who do not remember, they had Amazing Spider-Man 1, which was the first reboot after Sam Raimi left with Spider-Man 3 and all that. And Amazing Spider-Man 1 is a totally disposable whatever kind of Spider-Man film. It's fine.
Yeah.
Amazing Spider-Man 2 is a terrible, like, Batman v Superman level bad fucking superhero movie that also has had all those hooks in it with Spider-Man's dad and the fucking Green Goblin shit and the Oscorp shit.
And Sinister Six.
And Sinister Six. Like, there are all these little teases in that movie, and there are all these talks behind the scenes about, we're going to make a Venom movie, we're going to make a this and that, we're going to make a Sinister Six movie was going to be one of the things. And then, obviously, in Amazing Spider-Man 3 and all that. And Amazing Spider-Man 2 was so colossally bad a film that even though it didn't, as I recall, it didn't even necessarily bomb.
It did
right?
not bomb. It did okay. It actually did not do that much less than Spider-Man Homecoming. It was so clearly dead in the water.
Yeah, that it's like, it's not that it sunk at the box office. It was just that it sunk in the hearts of everybody that saw it. Presumably even the people at Sony that had greenlit all these movies, and they eventually saw the actual finished product, and they're like, we can't do this anymore, guys. Like, seriously, this movie fucking sucks. And all the rest of that, just the concept of an expanded universe Spider-Man thing is so bad for a movie. You just shouldn't do that. And so then I thought they weren't doing that anymore, and then now we're getting this Venom movie that obviously is, like, actually coming out, because there's trailers that it's coming out relatively soon. But they can't possibly make a Morbius the Living Vampire. That sounds like a joke we would have made based on, like, I remember the Reddit post I read back in Amazing Spider-Man 1 of the guy who was, I think it was Spider-Man 1, right? That had the post-credit scene.
Yes, where the guy comes into the prison.
The guy comes into the prison and we talked about it on the podcast of, oh, who could it be? And then I told the story of the Reddit post I read of the guy who was obsessed, so obsessed with the idea of that character being Morbius the Living Vampire, an incredibly obscure Spider-Man villain that in no way should be, Like, there are so many Spider-Man villains that they haven't really done in film that you would do before you fucking go to Morbius the Living Goddamn Vampire.
How far is this news from our joke back in the Amazing Spider-Man 2 days of a Pastepot Pete movie starring Daniel Day-Lewis?
It's like 2 degrees above. Yes. I would say because Pastepot Pete eventually graduates into being the Trapster, and the Trapster is just mildly more obscure than Morbius the Living Vampire.
Yes.
So it's like, it's almost there.
We're almost there. This is so fucking stupid. I don't even know why they're putting it out there. Because how, if you are Sony, can you look at that Venom trailer and not assume it's going to be a colossal flop? Seriously, mm-hmm. I've asked the question, why are they even releasing it? Why not just take the tax write-off? You would make uh-huh. more money doing an insurance write-off on that film than you would putting it into theaters.
Yeah, like, and then you get to like put it in some vault and it becomes an urban legend yes. and then like is discovered 15 years later and put out on like the Internet 2 or whatever yes. at that point.
Hence, it's the Roger Corman Fantastic Four effect.
Exactly.
Where yes. some people kind of like that movie because it was hidden from them.
Yeah, where if it had actually been released, it would have been completely forgotten to time as opposed yes. to being this weird, like, hidden, like, yeah. trivia bit.
Yeah. No movie in years has looked so obviously like a flop to me as that Venom one does. Uh-huh. It looks unbelievably horrible and just like no one's going to see it. And they're planning to do this. It's because these are all clearly vestigial parts of their weird expanded universe thing you were talking about that they've just decided to keep on, even though the world and Hollywood have completely and the other parts of their company have moved on.
Uh-huh.
Like, how is the Tom Holland Spider-Man and the cool animated Spider-Man you're doing, the Into the Spider-Verse film, how's that not enough for you?
Yeah, and the Spider-Man game, the Insomniac game. Like, yeah. Spider-Man is doing so well, broadly speaking,
right.
as a, like a property, and then there's somebody, there like there has to be one fucking executive at Sony that is just so hard on pushing this weird Spider-Man shit.
I think it's literally, it's a spreadsheet of how many comic book movies are they putting out, how many comic book movies are we putting out, we're putting out less, what do we own? All we own is Spider-Man, but we do own the component parts of it, so let's throw a dart at a board and see what villain we hit, and we happen to hit Morbius, who's an edgy actor who we could make a Hot Topic poster of a movie, let's do Jared Leto.
Like, that is the one part of this news that makes sense. If you accept the premise of Morbius Living Vampire movie happening, casting Jared Leto, I don't like Jared Leto. That is the perfect casting, because I don't really like Morbius Living Vampire that much as a character. He's kind of like, I would rather have Man-Wolf, who is J. Jonah Jameson's son, John Jameson, who turns into a werewolf because he's exposed to space bullshit. I'd rather have a movie with that character than, because werewolf movies are cool, because Morbius Living Vampire is not even really a vampire. He's not even really a vampire. He's like a weird science vampire. It's kind of bullshit.
It's so weird, because who are they expecting to see it?
Not me.
Who, like, is, do they think the rabid comic book Morbius fan base is big enough to make $100 million, which would not make you a profit this day and age?
I can assure you there is one Reddit user out yes. there somewhere. I wish I could find that post. When I saw this news.
But does that one Reddit user want to see him in just a random standalone movie without Spider-Man in it?
Maybe. I mean, he seemed to like Morbius okay. a lot.
Sure.
It seemed to me that he would have preferred if Spider-Man was out of the picture so okay. that Morbius could have more screen time.
Okay.
His beloved Morbius.
Well, maybe for that guy. I'm happy for that guy. I mean, this movie's not going to happen because Venom's going to flop and they're going to pull the rug out of it. But I don't know.
But that's, like, at least, because also it's like, you know, that Venom movie looks fucking terrible. The idea of making a Venom movie disconnected from Spider-Man is a terrible idea. But at least Venom is a popular character.
Yes.
There is a version of, like, I can understand somebody be able to sit in a room and pitch that movie to a, like, board of producers and people at Sony. And then, and like, show them a chart of, like, Venom is one of the most popular Spider-Man associated characters. And they all have amnesia about fucking Spider-Man 3. And they just, like, sign off on that movie. I can understand that. Even if I think it's a bad idea, there is no version of that meeting that I could possibly understand. Someone sitting down is like, here's a cover of like Spider-Man, maybe Spider-Man 80 or whatever the fuck, when Morbius the Living Vampire comes into it. It's like, look, he's so cool. He's a vampire, but not.
It just, but that's the thing. If you imagine the pitch meeting of like a young creative person coming in and being like, Boys, I'm going to tell you about my big idea. It's Morbius, the living vampire, I tell you. You can't imagine that. You have to do it in the stupid old-timey voice I just did because it sounds so stupid. So the only way you can imagine this movie being greenlit is what I said, which is the spreadsheet thing.
Yes.
And then they went and found some intern to go write the movie, and that's how you know it's going to be bad.
I love the idea that this movie has been greenlit and no human being has signed off on it, or like at Sony, like it was just, it's like HAL 9000 in 2001 Space Odyssey, or it's like a YouTube algorithm or something. They have so just like, you know, given up all their responsibilities and decision making to some sort of algorithm that it just produced stuff by like utterly faulty calculations, produced a Morbius living vampire thing and be like, we're going to cast Jared Leto as Morbius the living vampire. How does that sound? And like, and that's just how it happens. And nobody at Sony, everyone at Sony thinks that somebody else signed up on the idea, but nobody had any idea about it. It just happened.
Remember when the big hack happened around that Seth Rogen movie
for
Sony, where
right.
North Korea,
North Korea one,
different era with North Korea, where they got really mad about the Seth Rogen movie where they kill Kim Jong Il, and so they hacked the shit out of Sony and like decimated the company, and the movie had to be canceled and all this stuff.
And that's where we got all those fucking, like, weird emails and stuff from behind the scenes that were rough.
They were very rough. And everyone predicted, because that's also, that was one of the impetuses for Sony giving Spider-Man over to Marvel, because, like, they were just so decimated after, because that was the same year as Amazing Spider-Man. Like, it was just all, they were really fucked after all that. And everyone just assumed, like, Sony as a movie division is going to be dead. Like, this is it for them. I feel like it was. Like, they are dead. They are a reanimated corpse. That's what they are at this point. And they're like, Emily Grant going, Morbius, Venom. And that's, like, all they have. It's weird. It's very weird.
They should make a Kraven the Hunter movie.
They lost James Bond. They don't even have James Bond anymore.
They have nothing. They have nothing, but presumably they have the rights to Kraven the Hunter.
Yes.
I wouldn't. But I would watch a Kraven the Hunter movie.
Yeah. We are not reviewing Venom on this podcast, by the way.
No.
You've already heard my review. It's stupid. No. I don't need to see it.
There's a slight chance that when that comes out on like some sort of streaming platform that I already subscribe to, I will watch that movie, or like the first 10 minutes of that movie. I am dreadfully curious about it. I'm never going to the movie theater for it, though.
No. I'm excited to find when the runtime comes out and it's like a Jonah Hex situation where it's like 79 minutes, like just long enough to be considered feature length and not get sued, and that's what it'll be.
Fucking Jonah Hex, man. Fuck. It's bringing back memories of that, like, 2013, 2014.
Josh Brolin bounced back, luckily.
Yes, he's good.
Yeah, all right.
There have been a lot of bad decisions made around comic book movies in era of a lot of other good decisions being made.
Well, let's talk about another genre of movie. I don't even know if you want to call it genre. Movement of film that has never been good. Comic book movies are good, generally, these days. These are never good. This is video game movies.
Uh-huh.
So, Sean, let's do
There are four good video game movies. We have to always say that. There are four good video game movies.
American. Let's just say I'm going to... Hollywood movies.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then from now on, that's like...
Yes.
Just what we're assuming we're talking about.
Because you're referencing the Persona 3 movies from Japan. Yes. Yes. Those are good, but, you know, they know how to make movies over there.
Persona 3, the movie number 2, currently available on Netflix streaming still, I believe.
Yes, it is. All right. Let's do the easy one first. We've joked about this before without actually going into the details. Sean, there's a Sonic the Hedgehog movie coming out.
No!
This is happening. It is cast. It has a director. It has a date, November 15th, 2019.
That's way too soon.
It stars James Marsden and Tika Sumpter in the live-action roles. We don't know who they're playing. Jeff Fowler, a first-time director, is directing, and it's produced by Tim Miller, the director of Deadpool, who is a big special effects guy. And Fowler is, too. He's like Tim Miller. He's come up through the effects world. And why we're talking about this week is that this week, Deadline published the report, and it's since been confirmed, I think, that Jim Carrey has been cast to play Dr. Robotnik in the movie.
And they're using that terminology, right? Dr. Robotnik, not Dr.
Where
Eggman.
I saw. Some people put it in headlines as Eggman, but I think the release, like, who knows when they'll be called in the
Everywhere I saw it, it seemed like people were saying Robotnik.
This is
Eggman.
Not a, like, a press release from the studio, so we don't know what he'll be called, but it sounds like they're going for Dr. Robotnik, which is good, because that's better.
Yes, it's a better name,
Here's the thing. That gets my attention. That's not bad casting for Dr. Robotnik.
I mean, in so much as there's no such thing as good casting for Dr. Robotnik, you're not wrong.
I mean, I do think he's a Swiss Army knife. I do think Josh Brolin would be the best Dr. Robotnik, let's be honest.
Okay, yeah, I can see it, yes.
But I don't know, I just was like, oh, that kind of, that, I read that and it kind of perked up my attention, like, that's, one, Jim Carrey never acts anymore, and I kind of miss the guy.
Yeah.
I we found out recently he's been very sad for a while, and that's a bummer. And I'm like, that could be cool, but it's just, because the whole thing is they're planning this as a live-action animation hybrid. James Marsden and Tika Sumpter are live-action actors in it. Like, James Marsden is not voicing Sonic. We don't know who's voicing Sonic. I really hope it's Jaleel White. He's still around.
You can get him.
Get him. He's so good. But, or he was in the 90s as Sonic.
Yeah.
Anyway.
They're not casting Jaleel.
No, they're not.
That's never happening. No.
Anyway, but, I don't know if Jim Carrey, it's not clear if he is playing like a live action, he's going to be in prosthetics Dr. Robotnik, or if he too will be animated. The entire live action animated hybrid for Sonic sounds creepy and fucked up, and they shouldn't do that.
Yeah, because it is confusing, because I suppose Dr. Robotnik is a human, but also he doesn't look like a human.
No.
I hope that they basically go the Sonic the Hedgehog 2006 route with it, and there's Sonic, who is a anthropomorphic hedgehog guy, Dr. Eggman, that is some sort of mutant human that looks like Dr. Eggman, and then there are, like, real human being people.
Yes.
So there's, like, three kind of groups. There's the anthropomorphic animals, there's where the fuck Dr. Eggman / Robotnik are, is, and then there's Princess Elise and the other human being.
I hope this is just a
Sonic smooch.
I hope this is a straight-up adaptation of Sonic 06.
Yes.
Just go for it. Have Sonic just French kiss a human woman. It'll be great.
Yeah.
I don't think he actually French kisses her in the game, but they could, you know, they could up it a little bit.
They did in some fanfic I read.
Okay. Well, he's French kissed a lot of people in fanfic.
Oh, yeah.
Mostly Tails, but, you know.
And Knuckles.
Yeah.
And Knuckles. And Shadow, if you're feeling a little bad that day.
Sean, let's play a game.
Okay.
They haven't announced who's playing Sonic, Tails, Knuckles, all those people. Who should be doing the voices of those characters?
I mean, Sonic has to be one of the Chrises. That's where I mean.
But here's my view, because Sonic is black to me because of Jaleel White.
Okay.
So mine is Donald Glover needs to play Sonic.
Okay, that's a better idea, but it's going to be, I should have rephrased it as, it's going to be one of the Chrises. It's going
okay.
to be Sonic.
So Chris is Pine, Hemsworth, Pratt, or Evans. I could see that. I think Chris Pratt as Sonic feels fairly likely.
Yeah, if you're going for a goofier Sonic, you go Pratt. If you're going for a slightly more serious Sonic, I would cast Chris Pine.
Okay,
yeah. Those would be the two I would go for.
I still like my Donald Glover idea, because I think that's
great. I can see Donald Glover.
Donald Glover could be Knuckles, and then he could do the Knuckles raps in the movie, because he's that talented.
What if Donald Glover plays Sonic, Knuckles, and Tails, and just does all three of them? It's a voice role, so it's
I'd
like,
be up
you
for
can
it.
Do it. I think he's a talented guy. He could do it.
Knuckles is tough. Do you get, like, an actual kid, or do you get, like,
you
a grown...
You mean Tails?
What did I say?
You said Knuckles.
I said, I meant Tails.
I was very confused.
No, I meant... For Tails, it's usually, you know, voiced as, like, a younger person. Do you get an actual, like, little boy, or do you get a grown-ass woman doing a little boy's voice?
Oh, I mean, it depends on what you're... How active you want Tails.
Yeah.
I think my instinct is to do the traditional cast an older woman, but if it's, like, a Tails-centric thing, and it's about Sonic and Tails' relationship... I think then maybe you go for the young boy, and then it's like, you know, it's
an unknown
kind
of person that we don't,
coming from behind the scenes.
I think Amy is the one where we get a pop star to come in and voice it.
Yeah.
Amy is Carly Rae Jepsen or something.
Okay, yes. That's a more, I was going to say Miley Cyrus, but that's too dated. I'm too dated on that one.
And Carly Rae Jepsen has done voice roles for movies recently. I might not be wrong on that. That could totally happen.
Yes, it is 100% possible.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it is going to be like it's obviously going to be the celebrity voice casting thing. Because that's how Hollywood does this shit.
Yeah. And then Amy gets a song somewhere in the movie.
Yeah. I was also sitting here thinking I'm fine with the Jim Carrey thing, but what if you cast Vincent D'Onofrio as Dr. Robotnik and he did like just full on Kingpin from Daredevil style, just that whole thing?
That'd be pretty good.
I think he could. I would like to see him with like a big red handlebar mustache and a bald head. I think he could pull it off.
That's the thing. Vincent D'Onofrio looks enough like Dr. Robotnik.
Yeah.
He could actually do the live action.
Yes,
thing.
If you're doing live action Dr. Robotnik, Vincent D'Onofrio is 100%. That's the man I'd go to.
It would be close enough to like Dennis Hopper as Bowser. I think it could work.
Yes. In the great tradition of Dennis Hopper as Bowser, you cast Vincent D'Onofrio as Dr. Eggman / Robotnik.
John Leguizamo's got to be in this movie then. Who does he play out of the group?
Oh, jeez. John Leguizamo.
I'm just saying. He should be. He should be in more things anyway.
I think he'd be a pretty good Shadow. I think he could be Shadow.
That'd be great.
He'd bring the right kind of edge. You know, get some of that Tybalt energy from Romeo plus Juliet and put it into the Shadow.
That would be a great left field choice. John Leguizamo as Shadow the Hedgehog. Yeah. I'd be into it. We still have not technically picked Knuckles. I joked Don Glover could be Sonic or Knuckles.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Jeez. Because that's...
I could see, like, if they wanted to do, like, Knuckles as kind of a meathead thing, you could do Chris Hemsworth for that, if we're just still casting from the Chris's.
Yeah, but, like, there's too much of an accent, I feel like, with Hemsworth. Either, like, I'm sure he can do an American accent, but, I assume he's either Australian or he's whatever Thor is.
Right.
You know, this sort of, like, vague...
Yeah.
Western European, English, whatever it is.
And his American accent always winds up sounding like Thor, because he goes deeper and, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Knuckles is probably the tough one. In my head, because in the old animated cartoons, they just always put the fedora on him.
That's a good job.
Just have Harrison Ford do it, and just super old grizzled Knuckles.
Super, super old Knuckles. Or you could just do Alden Ehrenreich and just...
Yeah,
if you want to get Harrison Ford, you just get Alden Ehrenreich now.
I think that's
great. Harrison Ford's too old for the role. There you go.
There you go. Yeah.
The
There's a lot of
solo
good
Star
here.
Wars story reunion on the Sonic the Hedgehog movie.
Exactly. So anyway, there's our thoughts on that. So there are also, Sean, official Detective Pikachu and Mario movies happening.
Uh-huh.
Detective Pikachu is either still shooting or has wrapped principal photography. So like
no.
that's a thing. Ryan Reynolds as Pikachu.
No.
It's very weird.
Why?
And the Mario movie is happening at Illumination, which is up there with Donald Trump is president as like a thing I hoped would never actually happen. I'm kidding. But it is bad. It is fucking bad.
And in the like world of stupid news,
yes,
it's up there.
It's up there. Because Illumination Entertainment should not be allowed to do anything. Have you seen the trailer for that fucking awful Grinch movie they're making?
I didn't see the new trailer. I saw the original trailer.
Okay, there's a new one, and it's... I saw it was in front of one of the movies I saw recently.
Is Benedict Cumberbatch Grinch?
Yes.
My God.
I couldn't remember if
I made that up because that's such a bad idea if that's what they actually did.
Yeah, no, it's what they did, but he's disguising his own voice and it's weird. But yeah, they shouldn't be doing it, but there's that Mario movie, there's a Detective Pikachu movie, there's a Sonic the Hedgehog movie. Are we in a moment, and Sean, which of those three movies do you think has the chance of being good?
Detective Pikachu.
I do too, because that's weird enough of a thing, and it's like, it's not just doing a Pokemon movie.
Like, and because they're actually making it, so it's like, it feels like there's enough, like, because that Mario movie announcement was months ago, and we haven't heard anything
about it, because it's an animated movie, and those take forever, but it's happening. Like, Nintendo signed off, it's in production.
But they haven't said anything about casting or anything like that.
Again, I would assume that's 3 or 4 years off, because that's the standard cycle,
right.
But, you know... It's happening. This Sonic movie is happening. Like, it's crazy. We go in these cycles where, like, no video game movie has ever succeeded at the box office.
Yeah.
Ever. And somehow, we still try it. And one of these... Here's the thing. I think one or all of these could. I think that Mario movie is probably a hit. Because Illumination's movies are always hits. I'm going to hate it, but it's going to be... I think the Pikachu thing could be huge. Sonic will probably flop, because Sonic flops a lot these days.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's weird.
And, like, but what is different, and it's interesting that, like, all of these are kind of coinciding, is that it is... I feel like, typically, the what you think of as the video game movie is more that, like, T2M-rated game stuff of, like, Tomb Raider or Doom or Resident Evil or Silent Hill. You know, that's, like, generally where you go to. And this is like a bunch of kids' movies, you know, like animated kids' movies or like hybrid, like live action stuff. And that's where I feel like there's maybe a chance for those to succeed just because, like, if they fall into pitfalls, I don't think they're going to fall into the video game movie pitfalls. They're going to fall into the animated, like, kids' movie pitfalls, right?
Probably,
Like, those are different spaces, because, like, the video game movies all go into the same shit direction with their, like source material and go weird edgy with it and overly referential, but also not understanding anything about what made the video game story interesting or the characters interesting. And that's not, I think, exactly in play here. So
no,
I'm curious about them. I'll probably not see any of these.
No.
But I'm anxiously anticipating the trailer for Detective Pikachu so I can be convinced that movie actually is being made, and it has been made.
I don't know. You might just have an aneurysm when you see it, Sean.
I mean, that might be the end of all of it. It's just, yeah. Why?
Speaking of video game adaptations, Showtime has officially ordered a 10-episode first season of Halo. A Halo TV series. This is basically the same series that has been in development for years and years and years after the movie was in development for years and years and years. Microsoft was going to make this for Xbox before they decided to pull out of the whole TV thing. So Showtime has it. It's written by Kyle Killen, who is... none of his shows have been super successful, but he is a really acclaimed TV writer. He did the show starring Jason Isaacs called Awake that did make it a full season and is very good. He did a show called Lone Star at one point that only aired like 2 episodes because it flopped, but was, again, very acclaimed. So he is a good TV writer. It's directed by Rupert Wyatt, most famous for Rise of the Planet of the Apes, the first new Apes movie. So again, this is happening. It didn't just get a pilot order. It got a straight-to-series 10-episode season order. And clearly, like, this is Showtime's Game of Thrones. Everyone is trying to get a Game of Thrones. Amazon has Lord of the Rings. Showtime now has Halo. We can talk later on about how fundamentally they misunderstand why Game of Thrones is popular.
Yes.
But anyway, there's going to be a Halo TV series. It's going to suck. Like, let's just be honest. There's exactly zero precedent for this kind of thing being good. So we just have to prepare ourselves for that now. But it is interesting.
And it's just, it's something of where there was a time in my life where I was like, a live-action Halo movie or slash TV series, that could be good.
Yeah.
And that time in my life was 10 years ago when Halo 3 had just come out or was a year old now. Halo 3 is now 11 years old. And that was, because that's when it was like, oh, Peter Jackson was getting involved, and he had that, like, Halo Chronicles game that they were making and then got canceled, and then Neil Blomkamp, it was like, oh, Peter Jackson was like, oh, I'm going to kind of produce and oversee this thing, and Neil Blomkamp's going to direct it, like, hot off of District...
No. District 9 happened because Halo fell through.
That's right. No, so it's pre-District 9. Yes. And yes, that's right. The timeline was fuzzy for me.
Yeah.
So Neil Blomkamp.
That's how long ago this was.
Was totally unknown at this point, basically, for the wider world. Had made like short films and stuff.
He had made short films and he'd done the Halo commercials for 3 and ODST.
Yes. Yeah. That was a part of it, was the Halo 3 Landfall commercials, because there were like a whole bunch of those series of commercials, one of which being Halo 3 Landfall, which is basically like a 15-minute Halo live action short.
Yeah.
And they made all those fucking props for it, like a real warthog and assault rifles and all that shit. Then we got, fast forward to around Halo 4 is when we got the Forward Unto Dawn straight to YouTube, which
series.
Is, what a great phrase, straight to YouTube series, right? Like, that's the modern version of straight to DVD or straight to home video.
Well, except now YouTube is getting into the fucking streaming space and they just announced a show starring Kirsten Dunst, so they're serious about it.
Right, but they're making that fucking Karate Kid bullshit.
Which is supposedly really good, but I haven't seen it.
Okay. I'm sorry. But yeah, and the Halo Forward Unto Dawn is like an interesting fine curiosity if you're a Halo fan. Like, it's not...
Looks like it was made for Change Under the Couch.
But, yeah, it's like super cheap, but again, like, it was like, hey, I like Halo. Like, this thing's like... Because I watched those episodes when they came out. I think those episodes were like 15 minutes long.
Right.
It was like, I'll watch this thing. I think it would be a hard sit through to watch all of them through back to like as like the hour long or whatever like sort of movie it is. But like that thing was fine, and it was I remember there being one good scene within when the Elite lands on the planet and is like invisible, and there's a good fight scene with an invisible Elite, which was a good fight scene because you didn't have to have an alien there. It was just invisible. It was like that old rule of film of like, if you can make it for cheap, you're probably going to like be forced to make it way more interesting than if you could CGI the fucking alien in there. And so it's like, that was okay. That's fine. Then they made, is it called Halo Nightfall?
Yeah, the one about 5, the prequel to 5.
And the way it's Agent Locke and all that stuff. And I never saw that.
And that's the one that has the guy who plays Luke Cage as...
Yes.
Am I right about that?
Yes, it is Luke Cage. I can't remember what his name is. But yeah, it's him as Agent Locke, who voiced him in the game, but also plays him live action.
Yeah.
And yeah, I never saw that. But that was also through Showtime, wasn't it? Because I feel like this Showtime deal has been in place for a while.
I mean, it aired on Xbox. It was an Xbox exclusive thing.
Right.
They might have done it in some kind of like, cooperation. I don't remember that.
Because the original thing was in 2013, if you remember when they announced the Xbox One. They did the whole, like, Xbox TV thing, and that's where Quantum Break with its TV bullshit, and that game came out with the TV bullshit, but that was there. Everyone was confused. What is that? What is that even? I don't... Live-action TV video game? What the fuck does that mean? And then they also announced that Steven Spielberg was executive producing a Halo series, and I feel like that's where they said... My memory was, like, in you know, cooperation with Showtime or something like
it
that.
It could have been. I don't know.
But yeah, and they had like a very brief video of Steven Spielberg having been kidnapped. And this is like, hey, everybody, I'm proud to be here and help, you know, announce the next all-in-one entertainment system from Microsoft with the Xbox One.
I mean, Spielberg,
and making Halo.
Spielberg's been attached to Halo several times.
Yeah.
Because there was a point where he was going to be making a Fall of Reach movie. And I think that was probably the closest we ever got to a real decent Halo movie being made. Because it's the closest we've had to, like, a real decent filmmaker making the movie.
Yeah.
But, like, but that fell through. Because, I mean, it's following the same pattern, though, as every other game adaptation fucking ever. Which is that by the time this is coming out, Halo is so far past its main cultural moment. Like, this would have made sense in the late 2000s. It will be a full decade plus past the key moment where this could have been something. The show might be good. I don't know. Again, probably not, because there is zero precedent for this sort of thing working. And even if you have talented people attached, which they do, it's going to ultimately be written by a committee of people with, you know, conflicting interests who are going to want to sand it down and sand it down and sand it down until it's not Halo anymore and it's something else and it's not anything special or interesting, because that's every video game movie ever. See Tomb Raider earlier this year if you want proof. Like, that's what's going to happen. And I don't know. Like, Showtime is going to be putting in an insane amount of money into this because everyone wants to get their Game of Thrones. And I said this on Twitter earlier this week. Everyone seems to... Like, Hollywood has the weirdest fucking logic ever. Where Game of Thrones, when it premiered in 2011... Take yourself back then when there were not Game of Thrones think pieces on Polygon every fucking day despite it being a video game website.
Yeah.
Go back to when Polygon published video game articles, you know, and not Game of Thrones.
I'm not even sure Polygon existed in 2011 yet.
And Game of Thrones was like this weird up-and-coming fantasy show from HBO that
had Sean Bean in it, and that's why anyone paid attention, because he kind of looked like Boromir.
He did. And everyone, like, the question back then, all through seasons 1 and 2 of Game of Thrones, was, is this going to sustain long enough for them to do all the books? Like, is it going to be a big enough a hit that HBO can afford this thing? It was not a sure thing when it came out. And also back then, not many people knew about the books. They were popular books. They sold well when they came out, but they were not Harry Potter. They were not like a massive international sensation where like everybody knew A Song of Ice and Fire.
The first time I ever heard about it was when they announced that TV show and I saw Sean Bean. It was like, that kind of looks like he's wearing the Boromir costume. That's cool.
I only knew about it because my older brother read the books. Like, he was one of the people who like, he was a teenager when the first one came out and he got into it like right off the bat. But I didn't even know that this Game of Thrones show was based on those, because the first book is called Game of Thrones, but not the series.
Right.
So I didn't even know it by that name. So like, yeah, people didn't know about it, and it became a hit. Like, most things become a hit organically because of like quality and the moment and the content and the place it came out in for those reasons, right?
Yeah.
And so now you've got like, Amazon is getting Lord of the Rings to do Game of Thrones, and it's like, oh, Lord of the Rings is popular, so therefore everyone's going to watch it. Again, not learning the actual lesson of Game of Thrones, which is, like, find material you think is interesting and compelling and that you could develop on a wide scale. Like, HBO's already done it again with Westworld, which I think is a weird show that I don't really ever want to watch, but it's a hit for the same reasons. Like, you know, so HBO gets it, no one else does. And now Showtime's doing this with Halo, which is an even weirder, shakier proposition, but, like... Yeah, because this is the other thing about video game movies and things like this, is that there's two fan bases, potentially. There's people who don't know Halo who could come watch it, and there's people who do know Halo who could come watch it. Generally, the people who don't play that video game thing are never going to go see your video game movie because they feel, like, alienated from that community, and they're like, oh, that's a weird video game thing, and it's such a, like, there's kind of an iron wall still between, like, people who do and don't play these things sometimes.
Yeah. And then and also, the like, your thing is probably not going to be good enough or look good enough to attract them, and they don't know
on its own merits, right?
Yeah.
And the people who do like Halo, most of them have moved on to other series because Halo is just so far out of its moment.
Again, it's 11 years since Halo 3, which was the height of Halo's popularity.
Yeah. And the people who do really like Halo and are into it are going to be your harshest critics and are probably impossible to satisfy. So, like, it's just a bad idea. I don't understand why people still do this. Showtime is going to pour all their money into this, and they're probably not going to go out of business on this thing. It might do okay. It might do well enough to get a second season, but it's not going to be Game of Thrones. Amazon has already committed to 5 fucking seasons of their Lord of the Rings thing, and they're going to be spending, like, they've said, like, $1 billion on this. And, I mean, Amazon's not going to go out of business because of that, but it's going to take a lot for that Lord of the Rings thing to be popular. Because, one, it's going to have to be good, and they still haven't hired a writer. You know? So, like...
And then it's like that one has to live up to the movies.
Yes.
You know? And, like, and then the books. It's like, that's... Yeah, that's like a bad... Like, it's just, they're bad ideas.
They're all bad ideas. And no one understands why Game of Thrones is popular. It's so weird. Like, it would be more intellectually honest to just announce a series about a brothel where people are naked and killing each other all the time. That would be a better reflection of why Game of Thrones is popular, because in the beginning, Game of Thrones did get a lot of eyeballs for nudity and violence.
Yes.
Which it doesn't do as much of anymore, because it doesn't have to anymore. But, like, yeah, it's weird.
I'm looking forward to all the nudity and violence they put into the Halo TV show.
Yeah.
Because actually... Of course, they probably can't, because I imagine their Microsoft deal wouldn't allow that.
It's either Showtime or Starz. I think it's Starz. Starz did do, or does have a show that they tried to do a similar thing as Game of Thrones with. It's the Outlander series.
Hmm.
That I think is in its like 4th or 5th season. It has not lit the world on fire like Game of Thrones, but it is a healthy hit for them. And that's also based on a series of books from like... also from the 90s, that have a small fan base but are not so big that people come in with preconceived notions. And, like, that's smart. It did not turn out to be, like, a revolution for Starz. And I have not seen the show myself. I've heard it's good, but I don't really know anything about that series. But, like, that's what people should be trying if you're going to try it. Not Halo.
Yeah, because, like you said, people, like, the larger audience didn't really have any idea what Game of Thrones or Song of Ice and Fire were when Game of Thrones, the TV show, came out.
Yeah.
Like... You know, the original Westworld movie is, like, an interesting curiosity in the history of films. It's, like, a fine film, but, you know, nothing to, like, write home about. And the Westworld TV show is fucking... I haven't seen the second season. I might not. I don't know. But the first season that I watched is nothing like that movie in almost any way other than the vague conceptual premise of it. Which, even then, they take the premise in totally different directions. And so it is just, like... I think Halo is, as a property, is in so the wrong space. It's not in the zeitgeist, so it's not like right after Halo 3 where, you know, you couldn't fucking step into a store without being assaulted with, like, Halo merchandise and Halo-branded Slurpees and candy and, like, Doritos and Mountain Dew and everything all over the place. But it's also not so far in the past, because it's not in the past. They're still, like, making, like, Halo games and stuff. We just got that trailer for Halo Infinite that... people have kind of forgotten about it, and it can seep into the cultural subconscious for you to, like, rouse it up again and, like, do a different take on it.
And it's not evergreen like Pokemon and Mario, which, to their credit, those make sense as movies because Pokemon and Mario have always been popular and always will be. Like, those are just... those are never leaving the video game space.
And they're not narrative-focused
properties
either way, so you can and have to do whatever you want with them.
Yes.
There's no way to do a straight Mario movie, because there's not anything there to do a straight Mario movie on.
Yeah. So I don't know. It just feels like a dead end. And I don't... it's a frustrating moment, because I think we're maybe coming close to the point... we're not there yet, but I do think I'm starting to see the, like... first crumbs of the peak TV era collapsing back into just normal capitalism, which is where they funnel all their stuff into a small amount of projects rather than what we've had. Why we call it the peak TV era is that there's literally more TV being made now than at any point in the past, because there's so many platforms and so many voices are getting TV shows because everyone needs content. And so, like, TV has been the space to make interesting adult drama for the last 10, 15 years in America, as movies have kind of abdicated that space.
Yeah.
Things like this, like Amazon's Lord of the Rings and Halo, because here's the thing, all of those platforms will ditch all of that as soon as they have a hit. You know? Yeah. Like, So we're getting, but these things probably aren't going to be hits. But I don't know. At some point, I'm just seeing it off in the future. You can hear you can taste the hunger for everyone just wanting Game of Thrones, and they can stop doing their shows about women and minorities. Like that's, I hate to be that blunt,
right?
That's also just the history of TV. Like Fox as a network started out catering mostly to a black audience, and as soon as they got The Simpsons and some other hits, they canceled all their black TV shows.
Right.
And started making, like, the X-Files and stuff. You know, like, they had bigger hits. So anyway, that's capitalism for
yeah.
you. Let's move on.
I'm interested to see what the synopsis of, like, their pitch for this Halo TV show is going to be.
Do you think it'll have the Master Chief in it?
It shouldn't. That would be such a bad idea. Like, I don't know how you do. Like, yeah. I don't know how you use him. Like, because that Forward Unto Dawn thing did. And I think that was kind of a bad idea there, because as soon as he enters the picture, it's not interesting anymore.
But how do you market it? But that's the real big question, right? Because Halo itself has never been able to move away from the Chief.
Yeah.
I mean, except that two of its best games don't have him in it, but they decided not to go on that route.
Yeah, but yeah, as soon as Bungie left that franchise, instead of reinvigorating it with, like, going in a totally new direction, which was open at the end of Halo 3... 343 and Microsoft decided to sort of stay the course and do the Master Chief stuff again.
All right. Well, anyway, let's move on to some actual video game news.
Okay.
Here's kind of a sad, interesting thing to think about. Amy Hennig, who you guys would know as the creator of the Uncharted series, she was the kind of lead on those games, the first three Uncharteds, and then there was a kerfuffle over 4, and she left Naughty Dog. Amy Hennig then went to EA and Visceral Games to make their Star Wars game. We all know how that ended. Last year, Visceral was shuttered. But we did learn this week, Amy Hennig told Eurogamer that she left EA back in January, shortly after the shuttering of Visceral. She has since formed a small studio to work independently. But that's sad.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope whatever she's doing now, I hope good things come of it. And I hope she has a lot of success, and I want to play another Amy Hennig game, because I think very clearly the moment we are in of storytelling and gaming, her influence on that is incalculable,
yeah.
I think. But it's just, man, EA just chews people out and spits them up. It's so bad.
Yeah. No, it's a weird scenario, and it is sad just because she's, you know, Uncharted 1, 2, and 3 are some of the best games for the last generation.
Yeah.
As you said, like, her and the team she led at Naughty Dog, like, you know, pioneered what we think of as, like, the modern sort of cinematic action storytelling in games, and that quality of performance capture and animation and everything comes from those. And so it's like, it's frustrating to think that there is a decent chance that we will not have a single Amy Hennig game in, like, this whole generation of consoles.
Yeah.
That by the time, like, I don't know what their project is and, like, what the scope of this, like, smaller sort of indie team is going to be, but there's a very good chance that we don't see that game for 3 to 5 years.
It's a game where you go around and shoot executives at EA and Sony. It's just a revenge game.
Yeah, and make wisecracks after it. Yeah.
No, I don't know. Yeah, I just want to play more of what she has to offer.
Yeah.
And I feel bad, because that's, you know, I don't, even after having read some of the reports, I don't know exactly what happened on Uncharted 4. I don't know who was right or wrong. I think the end game came out just about perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
But who knows what was the right thing to do.
Making video games is hard, especially on that scale. So,
but that's a big AAA game she did that fell through, basically, for her at least. This Star Wars thing, I would have really liked to play that, but that fell through. And yeah, that sucks for someone who was, you know, really, really important to the industry in those years, where Naughty Dog was really ascendant in the PS3 era, you know? So it's too bad.
It's something that's weird. And, like, it kind of made me think of a similar situation, but like similar but different in some ways, is Ken Levine, who was the sort of creative lead on the BioShock games, or BioShock 1 and BioShock Infinite. For people who don't really remember, after BioShock Infinite, even though that game did really well, both critically and financially, that studio, Irrational, I don't think it got totally shut down, but it, like, kind of, like,
it got gutted.
It got kind of gutted, right, and turned into a sort of skeleton crew. And Ken Levine is still working with 2K, that publisher, but he like said, "I'm going to," like, kind of like what Amy Hennig said. It was like the phrasing was almost so exact. This is what reminded me of, like, oh right, Ken Levine was saying, "Oh, this is the indie moment." It was like 2013, 2014, right when, like, Gone Home and those games were coming out, and it's like, we're, this indies are so huge now. Like, I'm going to go, like, we people have a hunger for smaller scoped games made by smaller teams that can be more intimate in their storytelling. I'm going to lead one of those teams, and we have not seen anything from him since. Like, I think he was working on, like, a movie script and that kind of thing. He was working on a bunch of projects. Nothing has come out of that, and it's something that, like, bums me out because it makes me cynical and pessimistic just from the precedence of that, of video games are a weird business, and historically it does feel like, you know, a lot of the people we think of that have, like, led great teams, either, like, in the past generation or even further back, either have to go to Kickstarter, and then oftentimes the, whatever their projects are don't ever come out or come out weird and bad, or they just sort of disappear, and, like, who knows what the fuck Ken Levine has been doing for the past 5 years since Bioshock Infinite came out.
Yeah, it's weird. Let's move on to another piece of news, Sean. I just saw this today and I thought you'd like this. Shenmue 3, which is still a game coming out, apparently next year, but who knows. They put out on their Kickstarter page their PC minimum requirements.
Oh, right, I saw this.
Because they're having people, like, sign up, do you want the PC or the PS4 version? Which is good, they're meeting their requirements.
Yeah.
But they said here, the install size for the PC version of Shenmue 3, they're saying, is 100 gigabytes.
Great.
What the hell? Witcher 3, for reference, like, biggest open world I can think of is about 47.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's a normal-sized game. Call of Duty games get up to, like, 80, 90 because they have such high-res textures and stuff.
Yeah.
What the hell? Shenmue 3's 100 gigabytes.
I can't wait to see the Switch version of Shenmue 3 that's released on 17 different cartridges.
Yes.
It's like you walk out of a door, it's like, put in cartridge number 3. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like an old PC game.
Yes, yeah. Or an old PS1 RPG. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. That just sounds to me like...
a placeholder.
Yeah, like a placeholder. It's like, it's not going to be bigger than 100 gigabytes, so we might as well say that. And it also just feels like... because I feel like Final Fantasy 15 was another one of those games that just, like, became a ridiculous memory hog.
Yes. And, well, because they added so much
to it. Yeah, they added stuff on it, but it was also just, like... it feels like people have kind of, like, given up on compressing some of that shit, which is something that's, like, you know, you can get better audio quality and that kind of stuff, or if there's a bunch of video files, they can look nicer if you're not trying to, like, bump them down to meet those memory requirements, but it still kind of makes you roll your eyes a bit.
Oh, it does, all the time. Because, like, Call of Duty is a good example of this, because I think, like, Modern Warfare Remastered on my PS4 is 80 gigabytes.
Uh-huh.
There right, is yeah. No good justification for a remake of a game from 2007 being 80 gigabytes.
Uh-huh.
Zero. That game fit on a single-layer DVD. Like, it's just zero justification. And I do think it is a thing this generation that has been frustrating, is just a lot of studios just deciding compression doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, it's like, hey, we can put this out on a Blu-ray. We might as well just, like, fill up the whole fucking Blu-ray as much as we can.
Or sometimes we'll put some of the game on the Blu-ray and just leave the rest for a download.
Yeah.
And it's been kind of funny of, like, a lot of studios when they go to look at... because for the Nintendo Switch, you do have to compress because you need smaller memory sizes for a bunch of different reasons. And there have been some studios saying, like, we haven't thought about compression in a while. We don't know what to do with this or something. Or, like... you know, a developer like Panic Button, who's been doing the Bethesda ports, has had to get really creative because, like, Doom and Wolfenstein 2 were not particularly compressed on PS4.
Yeah, not designed to be, like, 30 gigabytes or whatever. I think Wolfenstein 2 is, like, 60 or something.
Yeah. So anyway, weird, but I just liked that note from Shenmue 3 because it felt appropriately quirky.
Yeah. It, like, I don't believe that it's going to be 100 gigabytes, but I like that number. It's just... you know, hey, we're maybe thinking about the next generation of consoles, and I look forward to us all them coming with, like, 2 terabyte drives in them, and that not being anywhere near enough memory by that point.
Yep. All right. Here's an interesting story this week. Kotaku, Jason Schreier, who always gets the scoops, had a story about how the headline was, Google is planning a game platform that could take on Xbox and PlayStation.
Nope.
Says, over the past few months, the wildest rumors in video game industry circles haven't been the PlayStation 5 or the Xbox 2. The most interesting chatter has centered on a tech company that's been quietly making moves to tackle video games in a big way. Google, the conglomerate that operates our email, internet browsers, and much more. So, Jason Schreier goes on to outline that all these things they've heard about Google's video game plans is that they want some sort of streaming platform with a hardware component, and they want to try to get some big video game developers. He also outlines... that Google has been trying to get into this space pretty much all decade. It's easy to forget, but they were in the bidding war for Twitch that Amazon won, which has paid off very well for Amazon. Twitch is huge. And Google has tried to get some other developers and things like Twitch, but it's always kind of fallen through. But there is chatter that they are going to be making a more heated push timed with the next generation of devices. Do you believe it, and do you think it will happen?
I mean, I believe that Google is talking about it 100%.
Yes.
I imagine Google has been talking about this kind of shit for a while. I think, I'm sort of 50-50 on whether any hardware actually is produced from their R&D stuff. I am, 90% if hardware is produced, it will fail almost immediately. Yes. Google is not a company that's this is not their expertise. This is,
even with their own, because they develop Android, which is obviously tremendously successful. But every time they've tried to make an Android phone, it's only gone so far. I think the jury is still out on whether the Pixel is a success. People but it's they have not even been able to get into the hardware market for their own software.
Yes, and even that hardware market is very different than the video game hardware market, where there is not a lot of room here. We're already seeing that with Microsoft, that it's Microsoft, in order to stay afloat, has had to be really competitive, as we saw last E3 with sort of trying to shore up and strengthen up their first party stuff. And it just feels like Google, there's not enough room in the tank for you guys. It feels like the Ouya, but with a lot of money behind it.
Yeah, I mean, the last time someone successfully broke into the console market was the year 2000 with the Xbox.
Yes, yes.
It has been 20 years. And so that means, on one level you could look at that and say, well, maybe it's time for someone else to take a swing at it. Or you could say, within those 20 years, there have been so many shifting power dynamics that even with these three studio companies, it still has been so unsettled for so long. Who's on top, who isn't. Nintendo coming in and out of resurgence, Sony coming in and out of popularity. Just the room doesn't really exist. And there's also the thing where you hear about this all the time, that Amazon wants to get into gaming, Apple wants to get into gaming, all these people. And what ultimately stops it, I think, is that gaming is not like TV. Everyone wants to get into the TV space, and all you really need is some money and someone who can write a TV show and some actors and some cameras and stuff.
And a little bit of a marketing budget.
Yeah. Those are renewable resources. Mm-hmm. There are always people who will want to write TV. There are plenty of actors in the world. There are plenty of directors. You're not going to run out of space to go make TV. We've seen that. With video games, you very well can run out of space, because there's only so many people who can do it on a technical level. There are only so many resources. It takes massive amounts of time to make video games. We have a very thriving indie scene with one or two people, small teams doing it, but that's different,
And then also, it's not if you're making if Google announced today, and Google might have this, I just have no idea, a TV content streaming service in the vein of Netflix or Amazon Prime TV, whatever, Hulu, whatever, all you need to do then is go out and license movies, TV shows, whatever, and then, as you said, get some people, there are a lot of people that can make a decent TV show, as we have seen in the era of peak TV, there are a lot of people out there that can make a fucking TV show, but then all you need then is a laptop or a TV, a smart TV that can have an app, or an existing video game console, a Roku, whatever. There are a billion devices that can watch any TV show, any movie that's on those streaming services, as long as you make the fucking app. Video game consoles don't work that way. It's a lot more complicated to get a video game on a dedicated piece of specific hardware. And so if they're putting out whatever, Google Xbox, Google Box or whatever, as their, or the Google Station, whatever the fuck you want to call it.
Google Station. And Googleplex.
Yes, the Googleplex. There you go. And you put it out there on the market, unless it is literally just a PC and that's it, it's a Steam box basically. And even if it is a Steam box, people still have to do work to get the game running on there. You need to make your fucking storefront, and you need to then, if you want to be actually competitive in the space, you need to have people making exclusive games for your thing, or nobody's going to give a fuck about it.
Yeah, and that's the challenge. A Halo only comes along every once in a generation.
Yeah.
And Microsoft gets down and prays to a bust of the Master Chief every day that they were able to launch with Halo.
If Halo was not Halo, the Xbox would have never taken off.
Exactly. So you need things like that. You need openings in the market. The other thing about this is Google talking about how they want to make it a streaming based thing.
Yeah. Too soon.
Too soon. Everyone's saying that. I wonder if genuinely people at Google look at that, and if there are people who like are not video game people and say, well, movies are streaming. Movies are streaming.
Yeah, I didn't.
Why can't we do gaming streaming?
Like, because
but seriously though, like,
yeah, no, the angle I was thinking of it from was the like, oh, it's a bunch of people in Silicon Valley who just like think, oh, like everybody has super incredible internet.
Yes.
And I think that that is true. I think there are a lot of people that have that kind of tunnel vision over there. It's like, ah, it'll be, it's the same like bullshit logic that made the original pitch for the Xbox One. It's like, you are an idiot. You're going to get eaten up because the market is more than San Francisco, assholes. Like,
yes.
You need to have a bigger view for what you're doing with this fucking project, and it's that libertarian tech asshole bullshit thing we talk about sometimes on this podcast. And I think that's part of it. But I think you're also right. I hadn't thought about that angle of them having no real conception of that streaming a video game is a much more difficult problem. Like, it's like hundreds of times more difficult problem than streaming video. Because
yes.
Streaming video is streaming video. We've been doing that for decades at this point. Streaming a video game, you need super low latency, lower latency than any video game streaming service that currently exists to be like, you know, preferable on a larger platform.
Yeah, you need technology that has not been invented.
Yeah, and an a national infrastructure that is not there.
And will not for the,
yeah.
Maybe in our lifetimes be there. So like, yeah, and because I know a lot of people in the industry are talking about this, and I think some of them, like Yves Guillemot, the head of Ubisoft,
yeah.
knows better and is probably just posturing.
Yeah, posturing and saying like, this is, obviously it's something they're looking into as like
right.
a future project. That makes sense.
Yeah. But then I think, I do wonder, because like, you know, Facebook has tried this, Amazon has tried this,
yeah.
Apple's like, and everyone kind of has this streaming mentality, but they're not video game people, so maybe they don't even know, like they probably know what latency is, but not how it would connect to video games.
Yeah.
Right? So, I think you put the tunnel vision and the we're not video game people in the same room, and you get this, and I don't think anything will ever really come of this from Google. I don't think they're going to launch the Googleplex or whatever. I don't know. Because again, the console space is in a really kind of exciting competitive space right
yeah.
now, but it's so unsettled and there's not an obvious lane to get into, you know?
Yeah.
Like if Xbox were truly, clearly dead, like on its way out, Microsoft had announced
if Microsoft was now where Sega was,
yes.
when Microsoft was trying to get in, because that's one of the things to remember is Sega was on its way out right when Microsoft was coming in, which like created a room and space.
And Sega had been on its way out for
yeah.
a decade.
Uh-huh.
It had been a long time, yeah. So like, and Xbox One has had a lot of problems, and I've made my predictions about it, but we are still years from the collapse whenever that happens, if it
yeah.
happens. So there is no clear opening. Nintendo has ballooned again, and this does not feel like a flash in the pan like the Wii.
Yeah.
The PS4 is super successful, so it's all unsettled. And I don't know there's a lane for someone to come in and be like, let's do our Googleplex device.
Yeah. If Valve has not made the Steam Box work, Google is not making their bullshit
no.
work, you know? Like, this also reminds me of Facebook buying up Oculus Rift and trying to do, like,
yes.
VR stuff, and that has, it's been, like, 3 or 4 years, and that has not gone anywhere, so.
One of the many times Facebook got to bed with a neo-Nazi and didn't realize it was a bad idea.
Yep, I sure do love those Facebook ads of folks that be like, hey, we fucked up, guys, but we'll be better. It's like, fuck you, Facebook.
Facebook, you market like a drunk stepdad, you know, romances, and I hate you.
Yeah.
I hate you. Anyway, here's something funny. So, Sean, Todd Howard, game creator extraordinaire.
Yes.
Recent E3 rock star.
Yeah, stand-up comedian, as we
yes.
all have come to know him. A man who can fucking rock a leather jacket, Mr. Todd Howard. Yes.
He gave an interview with German gaming publication GameStar, where he said the following quote, which I think opens us to our last news conversation. You cannot do crossplay in Fallout 76. We'd really love that, but right now we can't. Sony is not as helpful as everyone would like.
Yeah.
So just getting back to this, Sony is getting punched in the nose pretty much every day for this.
Yeah.
And yet they have not changed anything. They have
made... I mean, even if they have started the process of changing it, which I hope they have, it's going to be like a couple of months before it actually gets changed. Like,
yeah.
Sony is a big company. Like,
it
PlayStation
is
a big brand.
But like, let's just rack this all up. Because
yeah.
clearly there is a tidal wave of people in the industry who are not at Sony wanting crossplay.
Yes.
Right? So you have no less than Todd Howard and Bethesda saying, we would like our cool big new fall game, Fallout 76, to be crossplay compatible, but Sony won't do it.
Yeah.
So there's that. We didn't talk about this last week, but there's that new version of Minecraft that's out, and it
yes,
launched
the
on
All the, for One or whatever.
Yeah, it's the Bedrock update, whatever they're calling it, but it's on Nintendo Switch now, And Nintendo and Microsoft did a big marketing run together on it, where like you had an Xbox controller and Joy-Cons in the same ad, which was pretty trippy,
yeah.
And basically just making fun of Sony over it. And it is weird. I logged into my Minecraft on Nintendo Switch with my Xbox gamer tag. That was fucking trippy. But anyway, so there's that.
I think you got on an NSA watch list for doing that. It's not right.
It's not right, yeah. So anyway, they're making fun of it. There's the whole Fortnite thing going on. Sony has said they're looking into the Fortnite thing, but they haven't changed anything or promised to change anything. I still think it's entirely possible that Sony's strategy is wait for things to blow over and we're not going to lift a fucking finger on this because we don't have to. We've got the, you know, Scrooge McDuck vault of money.
Right, yeah. We have like 80 million PS4s or whatever in the market.
Yeah, and yeah. Everyone else can go fuck themselves. I honestly do think that's probably the most likely thing based on Sony's past and their behavior this generation. But when you have, like, all the way up to Todd Howard, just because there was a point where people were frustrated about the cross-platform thing, but they would kind of disguise it, and they wouldn't just come out and say, Sony's fucking us on this.
Yeah.
But when Todd Howard is just out there saying, we wanted to do it, and Sony fucked us on this, like, that is kind of a tsunami. Like, that is a tidal wave of, like, pressure from literally everybody else in the industry wants to do this. Sony doesn't. Sony is up on top, so they don't necessarily have to hear the peasants screaming at them. But I don't know. It's an interesting moment.
Yeah, it's something of the reason why I feel like there's a decent chance that Sony moves on this is because it feels like it's like bigger companies, you know, because back before, like where this conversation started mostly was around like Rocket League and smaller games like that. And it was enough to be like, oh, it would be cool. But also like even whatever, like the crossplay stuff would be relatively inconsequential because it's not like, oh, I have my PSN friends list that I can like send an invite to my like an Xbox Live person. Like you have to build the infrastructure in the game to make those different network infrastructures like communicate that way. So yeah, like you'd have to build like a game specific friend list and all that kind of bullshit. But the industry is very much moving in the direction of these like big games of service type games that have their own friends lists and their own network features and infrastructures that are updated constantly. And Fortnite is like the shining pinnacle of that. That is a game that I don't play, but I am constantly seeing tweets or like news updates on different game sites about whatever random bullshit Fortnite is doing. It seems like they got like Epic knows how to foster the success that they've had with Fortnite and is just constantly updating that game and doing new stuff with it. And if you're having games themselves act as these larger platforms, and then it seems like maybe that is kind of the space that Bethesda wants to put Fallout 76 if it's successful, then that's where like crossplay is more meaningful because then the developers have the motivation to build that infrastructure and that platform for that game. And therefore crossplay is not just you have a larger pool of random players to match with matchmaking. It is I can use my in-game friends list to invite my friend who's playing the like iPhone version of the game, and my other friend that's playing the Switch version, and my other friend that's playing the Xbox One version, and the game maybe has like a party chat system and all that stuff built into it. With those like bigger developers, if they are moving into that space, there's then a lot more of a motivation, I think, for Sony to then yield because the crossplay thing becomes way more meaningful than it was before.
I agree with all of that. I also just think, like...
No, I think, like, your position is also possible.
There's a significant chance that all of that could be true, and Sony could look at all that, and then it could check its bank account and say, we're fine, we're not going to move on it. I think it would be smarter for Sony to skate where the puck is heading, to quote Steve Jobs or something. But, like, they don't always. Like, they're not a very reactive company. Like, that's just a thing to remember. Like, this is... They have made a lot of good moves this generation to become popular, but a lot of that has kind of just been like staying the course and doing the making good games well thing well.
Yeah.
A lot of the like service components, like they have not hit back at like any of the major developments Microsoft has made to try to be more competitive with them. They have so fundamentally ignored that. I think Sony publicly commenting on this very much opens the door for that. I think if they really were committed to just staying the course and ignoring the crossplay thing, they wouldn't have publicly commented on it at all.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, like, news cycles move on. Things happen. I could very much see, like, in a couple weeks, people aren't talking about this as much. You know, the Fortnite fan base is maybe annoyed at it, but they just stopped playing on PS4. And that's fine. And Sony doesn't so much care about that because I don't know how crucial Fortnite is to their business.
Yeah, but like I guess like where I'm saying where I think the thing that would cause Sony to move is if this is a trend that is going to continue and that Fallout 76 is going to become a game like that.
Yeah,
if Fallout 76 going to be more of these on consoles.
If Fallout 76 sells Fallout 4 numbers and stays in the news like as a major video game thing for months on end.
Yeah, and let's it creates this like big like community and stuff.
If it's a Destiny level hit or something.
Yeah.
And Todd Howard is out there saying we want crossplay. Yes, I could see that. Because that's the thing, Destiny, it'd be great to have crossplay. It'd be really great to have crossplay on Destiny. But Bungie has never been out there banging the drum for that.
No, like because they probably don't want to like have to build all the shit to do it.
No.
Because it sounds like Bethesda has already made the stuff for Fallout 76. Obviously, Epic already made the stuff for Fortnite.
Yeah. So I don't know. But it could also, I think it's going to take a while to find out. And I think probably the single most likely scenario is they do a limited fix for Fortnite, but not for anything else.
Yeah, because the account shit with Fortnite is a little bit different than just the crossplay thing. Like,
yeah.
you could like do a make good on some of that account horse shit on the Fortnite one,
yes.
Which is like a step above. Like, we don't want like crossplay.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be able to like block people being able to sign into an account that signed on a different machine. That's stupid.
Yeah, but we'll see. It's a weird moment.
Yeah,
but anyway. Sean, that's the news. Let's talk about some stuff.
All right.
What have you been up to?
A couple things. Like you said, it's mostly been video game stuff. I'm going to go with the most surprising thing, and we could have segued this earlier, but I didn't think into it. I'm just going to say what game I've been playing, and then I'm going to tell you the very logical, concrete pathway by which I reached that point.
I'm excited.
Yeah, it's like I've been watching all those Sherlock Holmes shows, and that's
something
that Holmes says all the time. If you present someone the results of the deduction without giving them the path, it's a lot more theatrical.
Yes.
So I've been playing The Amazing Spider-Man 2 on Xbox 360.
Isn't that the game they pulled off the storefront?
That is a game that is in that weird fucked up licensing situation where Activision no longer has the rights to Spider-Man, so they're like, fuck it.
And how have you been playing it? On
Xbox 360, because the Xbox or the PS4 version is way more expensive. And I saw you, Jonathan, just now, to break down the Iron Curtain. You glance over at my entertainment station and note the fact that there is no Xbox 360 hooked up next to my PS4 where I normally play video games. That's because my dad owns an elliptical machine, which is, you know, like a cardiovascular exercise machine that is upstairs. And I use that sometimes. And we have a little TV hooked up in that room, and I have my old Xbox 360 hooked up there. I usually use it, so if I'm on the elliptical, I usually watch like anime or something on there. Occasionally I will play games. That's how I played, the old Call of Duty campaigns for like Black Ops and Black Ops 2, and the ones I missed. Was I just bought old used copies of those on Xbox 360. Those games you can play with your fucking eyes closed, basically, because if you play a Call of Duty campaign on normal, it's a game that basically plays itself. It's shit that explodes.
Yeah.
If you're just, like, on basically a treadmill, it's fine. You can just play it, and it's a good way to sort of, like, distract yourself while you're exercising. I also played in just an inhuman amount of Dynasty Warriors Gundam 3 that way, because, again, that's a game that's, like, I don't need to pay attention. I can just hit X, 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 Y, and robots explode, and I'm having a good enough time that I can, you know, burn some calories, and that's fine. And so it's like, it's a venue where I very occasionally will play an Xbox 360 game that I do not need to pay any attention to at all. And I have also been, since the Insomniac thing, been in this, like, deep Spider-Man hole. I just earlier today read, it would be Spider-Man issue 48, I think. So I've been reading Amazing Spider-Man issue 48. Spider-Man issue 48 is different than The Amazing Spider-Man issue 48, because talking about comic books fucking sucks. And I've just been feeling like, I want to play some Spider-Man stuff, and there are no Spider-Man games that you can play on the PlayStation 4, because they released, the only one I think that would have been released is Amazing Spider-Man 2, and I guess if you count like Lego Marvel Super Heroes or something, but I'm not going to play those, that's different. But you can't just download Amazing Spider-Man 2 on any platform it was originally available for, because Activision does not own the rights, and it's stupid, and I guess whatever their deal was if we don't have the rights anymore, it's not going to be on the storefront. I don't understand how that shit works. That doesn't seem like it should make sense. Apparently it does in the world of business.
I like the idea that, like, now that Amazon owns the rights to Lord of the Rings, like, all the Peter Jackson movies just go off of, like, iTunes and everything.
They just disappear. It's like, well, yeah, like, we own it now, and you can't watch those old. It's like, I don't understand how the fuck those deals work. But it seems like all that, like Ultimate Marvel vs. Capcom 3 had all those issues. I don't understand how Activision worked that shit out. And so if you remember when I talked, made my like impromptu top 8 or whatever it was Spider-Man games I played, I mentioned then that I had been, I kind of had wanted to play the Beenox Amazing Spider-Man games because they made Amazing Spider-Man 1 and 2 after they like were, they're thrown into the licensed movie game mines by Activision back when those were still a thing. And but then when they lost the license, all they were hard to find, and even getting physical copies were very expensive. What I didn't put together at that time was I had this situation in which I could play a bad Xbox 360 game and not mind it, because I wasn't thinking about Xbox 360 games. It was like, oh, and so I didn't check. I just assumed they would be as expensive as the PS4 one, because the PS4 version, getting a used copy of Amazing Spider-Man 2 on the PS4 is like $70 or something.
Jesus.
That's never happening, you know? But apparently, I guess maybe they just printed a lot more of the 360 PS3 versions, which would make sense.
Or they just didn't sell.
Or they didn't sell, or probably both, I imagine, because they were, because that game came out in 2014, so, you know, a long time ago, back when there were a lot more 360 PS3s than there were PS4s. So you can actually get a used copy of that game for Xbox 360 for like $12 or something, which I was like, I am willing to pay that price to play this game. I only got it yesterday, so I've only played, I could play basically exactly 1 hour. I played 700 calories of that game. and it is really weird. It's kind of interesting. It is an open world game, and it has like the web swinging stuff, and it does something with the web swinging that I haven't seen any other game do, where it ties which hand you're swinging from to the triggers. So R, right trigger, does your right hand. Left trigger, does your left hand. Which is a cool concept. In execution, it's utterly meaningless, because basically the way the algorithm works that calculates which building you're connecting to, it's just always the closest building, regardless of which trigger you use. So it's like, normally what that control scheme seems like it would be useful for is, I'm on like the right side of the street, but my objective is over on the left, and I want to make a left turn, so I hit the left trigger, hook to the building to my left, and like the pendulum physics swing me around. In that situation, even if you use the left trigger, it will still hook to the building to your right that's closest to you, and so it's pointless. I don't know why. And I guess the thing with Amazing Spider-Man 2, the game, is it feels like Beenox had all these ambitions, and then Activision showed up and said, you're making a licensed movie game, it's going to come out in 2 months, and they're like, we just finished pre-production, and they're like, it's coming out in 2 months, and it's like, well, fuck. And it's kind of what this game feels like, that there's like a dialogue wheel in this game, it's not like there are many dialogue choices, it's more like, do I want more exposition on this plot, or do I want to just move on dialogue wheel? But there's like a full, like, you sit down on the couch and have a conversation with Aunt May, you know, like, this game is trying to do stuff with Spider-Man. They do the thing that this new Insomniac game is going to do, where you have the different unlockable outfits are, like, in the game, and they have different sort of abilities associated with them, which is something that Insomniac has talked about. They haven't really shown it, but that's something they said that they're going to do with this new game. And so this one, none of the costumes, they picked a bunch of bad costumes, but if you want, you can play instead of with like the only good thing about that movie, the Amazing Spider-Man 2 costume. If you don't want to use that one good costume design they had, and you want to go with the shitty Amazing Spider-Man 1 costume, it's unlocked for you from the beginning, and I think it does more combat damage, but doesn't give you as much reputation or some bullshit. So it has some of that stuff in it. Stan Lee plays like a full character named Stan Lee, who runs a comic shop, and that's kind of charming. And then the combat is the most brain-dead version of the Arkham combat I have ever seen. And it basically, what it reminded me of is, it made me think back to that time, Jonathan, when I saw you playing Arkham City and you were just mashing on the X button as furiously as possible. And I just said, don't do that. Like just press the X button once and Batman attacks once. And that Arkham combat is built around like very deliberate like button presses and actions. And that's how that combat works. Amazing Spider-Man 2 is no. Like, you're just mashing on X as much as possible, and then when the entire screen just flashes red, you press the Y button, do a counter, and then you mash X as much as possible. There's a chance that the combat gets more complicated.
So it's a game for me circa 2011.
Yes, it's a game for Jonathan circa 2011, but also it looks bad. I mean, it's an Xbox 360 game, so like it's been a while since I played one of those. It doesn't. The city is very barren. It's very flat. The Spider-Man model does not look great. The best thing about the game, though, and just as like legitimately, it it's something that put me in this weird headspace of what if, like, Amazing Spider-Man 2 could have been a decent movie. Is the plot of this game, at least from the... I know for sure, because again, I've only played the first hour, and it's definitely eventually going to get to the Electro stuff and everything and the bullshit from that movie. But the setup of this game goes in a totally different direction, where it takes that weird hanging plot thread those movies had of Uncle Ben's killer, that Spider-Man never caught Uncle Ben's killer, something I had totally forgotten about until this game reestablishes that fact. And in the beginning moments of this game, when you're chasing down Uncle Ben's killer in this whole car chase thing that is in every Spider-Man game ever, where you're like hanging on the top of the roof and all that shit, he gets away, and then you catch up to him, but he's been murdered by someone that the media is calling the Carnage Killer, who is Carnage, the Spider-Man villain, Cletus Kasdy, who is a serial killer going around and murdering other criminals, and that's the setup for this game. And I am now so fascinated by them introducing Carnage in a game where there are no symbiotes. Because the whole thing with Carnage is that, like, Venom, the Venom symbiote character was a character for a while, and then Venom basically asexually, the symbiote asexually reproduced or whatever, had like a split off, and then that symbiote thing hooked up to the serial killer Cletus Kasdy, and he became Carnage. That's the whole point of the character, is that he's a completely unhinged Venom. But there's no symbiote in this universe. And so now I'm utterly hooked on this game of, like, I really want to play it now, which is good because it makes me want to actually exercise. It's like, I have to find out, what the fuck do you do? How do you have Carnage in a game where there is no Carnage? So, Amazing Spider-Man 2 is weird. It's a weird game, John.
That's actually not a bad setup for a Spider-Man story.
It's pretty
deep. Carnage kills Uncle Ben's killer, and then he's like, what do I do about this?
Yeah, it's a totally different setup that, like, would have been a better premise for the Amazing Spider-Man 2 movie, especially because I haven't seen what they actually do with Carnage, but it's going to at least have to force them to do a slightly different take on that character because it's divorced from the Venom stuff, which sounds kind of appealing to me. Yeah. Way more appealing than I'm, like, dreading actually getting to Electro and all that shit.
Do they do, like, the thing where the characters are supposed to look like Andrew Garfield in that
show? Oh, yeah.
But they're not voiced by them, I assume?
No, definitely not. The Peter Parker is voiced by the guy, Sam Riegel, who did the voice for Teddy in Persona 4 Golden. Which is weird, because I just can't unhear that voice. So it's like when he does a totally fine Peter Parker, but it's like...
He doesn't go around and make bear puns all the time?
No, yeah. But it is, every time I see that it's supposed to be Andrew Garfield Spider-Man, it makes me feel bad.
Yeah.
And it's like, who played Sally Field, who played Aunt May, is like, it's that Aunt May and stuff. And so it's like weird when I see the stuff that is like directly connected to the movie, because everything else I've played so far has nothing to do with that fucking movie. It feels like it's a totally different Spider-Man.
Nice. Emma Stone was doing some video game voices at that time. She was in Sleeping Dogs.
She was the girlfriend in Sleeping Dogs that only has like a couple dozen lines of dialogue. And I was always confused that she wasn't in that game more.
I mean, they probably like had her record her part while she was like in a limo going from one premiere to another premiere.
Yeah.
And then they paid her $100,000 or something. But, you know, it's Hollywood.
Yep.
All right. Let's talk about a game we're both playing right now.
Okay.
So we've also both been playing The Last of Us. Yes. I assume this is the game you've actually been like sitting on the couch focusing on.
Yes, no. Yes. The Last of Us would be a very bad game to play while on a treadmill or an elliptical.
Yes.
Yeah, you can't do that.
So I've been wanting to replay The Last of Us since E3. You have too, I assume.
Yep.
And my brother, who recently got a PS4, just bought The Last of Us because they did that new thing where there's the PS4 greatest hits.
Right, yeah.
Which I like because Yakuza 0 is now $20.
There you go.
And Yakuza Kiwami is now $20. And at some point, I can pay $20 and get those games.
Yep.
Anyway, well, $40 for both of them. But, so he got The Last of Us, and I'm like, well, fuck. Now I'm not going to be able to resist it. If, like, he's talking about The Last of Us, I have to play The Last of Us. So, even though I'm playing, like, 5 other games right now, which you'll hear about, luckily none of those are games with stories. So, I sat down and started playing The Last of Us. And it has been, the last time I played it was 2014, when the remaster came out.
Me too.
That remaster came out less than a year after the original. And I think the last time I played it, it was, like, a little too soon. Like, I still really enjoyed it, but it was like, it didn't grab me the same way because it had just come out on PS3, right? Well, now it's been years. It's been 4 years. We've had a whole console generation kind of come up since then. And I think The Last of Us is that exceedingly rare game that has not just aged well. I think it's gotten better with age.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I think The Last of Us is not the last game of the last generation. I think it's the first game of this generation.
Yeah, I basically agree.
It is. There are some things like technically that put it in opposition to some games from this generation, like its use of pre-rendered cutscenes and things like that.
And like some of the environments are a little flat in that you can kind of see the PS3 in it.
Right. But overall, I mean, I think in terms of narrative and how it blends gameplay and narrative together and what a complete package it is as a game, it really feels like it belongs on the shelf with like The Witcher 3, mm-hmm. or some of the big games from this generation, you know, Breath of the Wild or something. Like, just it feels like not just a technical achievement, but where it has taken what you can do with the video game medium experientially, I might be enjoying it even more this time than I did 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And because I was kind of just going to play it casually, and I just found myself so immediately hooked. Like, I teared up again when Joel's daughter dies at the beginning. Yeah. It's like, spoiler, but it's like, oh my God, Troy Baker is selling the shit out of this. Oh my God, this scene is just unrelentingly harrowing. And then from there on out, I don't think I've ever appreciated the opening stretch of this game so much, because The Last of Us is slow.
Yeah.
It is a slow-ass game that takes its sweet fucking time. Like, I still have not gotten into the point where I consider the main plot of The Last of Us has kind of kicked in, you know? Uh-huh. Like, I'm on the journey with Ellie. But The Last of Us, very much, its structure is novelistic. It is something that spends a lot of time establishing things, and like a good book, you read it a little bit at first, and then you picks up more, and it picks up more, and then, of course, by the end, I know I'm going to be playing like 8 hours of this in one sitting or something.
Yeah.
But I'm just amazed. I really do think, like, as a gameplay achievement, The Last of Us, I did not realize how much, it's been 4 years since I played this. Every single combat encounter in this game, and I don't mean section, like Pittsburgh. I mean every part in Pittsburgh where you meet enemies, is etched into my memory like it happened to me.
Uh-huh.
And I remember every inch of it. It has not necessarily made it easier because it's a hard fucking game. But like, it is, like the combat and the stealth and all those mechanics are so perfectly tailored to put you in the shoes of Joel and Ellie, and the environments for those combat encounters are so exquisitely laid out to maximize tension and what this game wants out of you, that like, I think it is still one of the most riveting games to play. And I also still think there's something radical about how much time it spends just having you walk around and look at things that I think we're still catching up to.
Yeah.
So we're going to do a bigger piece on this at some point. But The Last of Us is amazing. You go.
Yeah, so because it is something that it feels like... Like you said, the sort of the memory thing is something that has just struck me a lot playing it. Of there are games that I have gone back and replayed or replayed bits of that I had played 2 or 3 years ago that like are totally fresh to me. And this is something I haven't played 4 years ago and then like 5 years ago with the first time through. And there are, like you said, every time I'm coming up on like where a combat encounter is, I remember.
Yep.
I'm seeing this thing. It's like, it's this combat encounter. And then I also remember specifically, it happened to me very vividly in the section where Ellie has the rifle and is covering you. And I saw that, I'm like, I handled that section in a totally different way than I played it the last two times. And then when I was like kind of walking around the area to pick up like the last little, make sure there wasn't any ammo or something I was leaving behind, I went to a building and turned a corner and saw this wall and immediately flashed back to, oh, right, like this is the first time I played this game. This is where this is how this combat encounter went, and it went nuts, and I never went up on this catwalk that I did it this time. I like went around and in this building and like kind of like went around this building and lost them in it, and then like did a full like stealth, like, you know, started stealth, broke stealth, and then entered stealth again by hiding in this building. And then while they were looking for me in this little building on the side, I like picked them off one by one. And I had a total flashback to that encounter, which is something that almost never happens to me in games. Like, it's only my absolute favorite games, like Ocarina of Time or Halo 1, and even then it's only, like, very periodically, and I feel like it happens constantly in this for me.
I actually had been, because we did our big Halo 1 playthrough last year on our YouTube channel, and I found myself thinking about this game on the same terms I do Halo 1, where, and we talked about this, Halo 1 is pretty much a perfect game in how its campaign is laid out, in just that it does everything in it is there to challenge you in a specific way and build the pace of that game in a specific way. And The Last of Us is like that. This is a game that takes its time, but there's also no fat on its bones.
Yeah.
It really, if it's throwing something at you, it is there for a very specific both gaming and sometimes narrative or atmospheric reason, and it is a challenge with actual meat and dimensionality to it. And I think that is an exceedingly rare thing in a video game.
Yeah.
Because there are plenty of video games that are great, that are A-plus all-timers, but you could not say that about them. You know, I'll also say one of the reasons I'm playing The Last of Us is that I was playing the Tomb Raider game.
Yeah.
And it was disappointing, and it just made me want to go play a Naughty Dog game. So I'm playing a Naughty Dog game.
Yes.
And one of the things I realized playing Tomb Raider again is that the combat has no rhyme or reason in Tomb Raider. They're just all over the place.
It's there because it needs to have a combat system.
Yeah. And it's, at least in the first one, the second one paces it better. But in the first one, it's just kind of constant that you're fighting people. They kind of come out of, you know, hiding places at random in the middle of an exploration part or something, and you shoot them all, and there's not much challenge, and the rooms aren't laid out in ways that makes them feel like these glorious puzzle boxes or anything. And it also doesn't make me feel like I walk away from those with any real understanding of my place in this world. And that's okay. You don't need that for a game necessarily. But Naughty Dog does it so well, and particularly in The Last of Us, because I come out of, like, every combat scenario feeling closer to Joel.
Uh-huh.
Because I feel like I am in that body more. And it is a game based on such immense physicality. Like, so my brother's playing it, and he's not sure how he feels about it yet, which I had to stop. I was going to say, that's where I was at this game when I first played it too, Thomas. I was like, right, you know what, I'm just going to let him experience it, and hopefully he comes around to my way of thinking, we'll see. But like, that very much, it is a game to me where, like, you kind of have to learn what it is because it falls into no genre.
Yeah.
Like Thomas said, he wasn't enjoying the stealth mechanics much, and I wanted to say it's not a stealth game. It has stealth in it. But what it is it's not Hitman. It's not a game where, like, you can do everything stealthy and then walk out of the building and, like, straighten your cufflinks and be all cool. It's not that. There are very few encounters in The Last of Us where you can genuinely get by everything with stealth and then walk away unscathed. Here's how most encounters in The Last of Us go, is you pick off one guy with stealth, you might pick off another guy with stealth, you'll go around, you'll move, and then something happens that you could not account for, and it's like, okay, I had been counting my ammo closely, I've been counting my shivs closely, but fuck it, it's go time, I have to survive, and you just start, you know, pummeling people with your fists and losing health until maybe, if you win, you walk away from the encounter dripping blood, your health meter is almost depleted, you have no bullets left, and Joel can't even walk at full speed because he is so damaged, and then you're like, oh my god, that's The Last of Us.
Yes.
And there's no genre for that.
Yeah, it's like it's a survival game, but not in the way that, like, you know, Rust or DayZ or whatever, those are like survival games. It's probably in the sense of, like, that is where the tension and, like, the drive of the mechanics and the story come from, is this, like, need to survive. And, like, in pursuit to that, this time I'm playing on the, I think they call it Survivor difficulty.
Yeah.
Because they added another difficulty, Grounded, in Remastered, which I have not touched. But the last two times I played it hard both times.
Yeah.
This is the first time I'm doing the Survivor difficulty, because the reason why I never did it before was they turn off your listening mode, which really intimidated me when I saw that. And I was like, fuck it. I've played this game twice. I probably should have just played it Survivor the second time I played it, but I was too much of a coward to do it that time. I'm going to, like, commit and do it Survivor. And The Last of Us is one of those rare games where the different difficulty modes change what the game is. Like, fundamentally, Last of Us on normal, like, must be such a, like, just because I know, like, Hard and Survivor are very different. I've never, like, played anything of The Last of Us on normal.
I know, I haven't either, yeah.
Yeah, but I can only imagine, my vision of The Last of Us on normal is you enter a house and every single, like, drawer has something in it. And, like, every room has a little, like, health thing, and there's a... Because on Hard, stuff is scarce. On Survivor, it's like you get, like, 1/4 of a thing of, like, scissors or, like, the cutting stuff for your crafting supplies, and it's like, I need to have a birthday party. Like, I just cleared 3 houses and found fucking jack shit, but, like, a screw on the ground that I can maybe one day turn into, like, an extra bullet I can put to my pistol. And so, yeah, Survivor really ratchets up that sense of there, like, this world has been picked fucking clean, because it's been like 20 years or whatever it is, like 15 to 20 years since the apocalypse.
Yeah.
Every area you're moving through has been picked clean by Bill or the hunters in Pittsburgh or whoever. And so it's so, any resources that are usable are so scarce that I'm even more so on Hard, have to constantly be counting, like, okay, this is how many revolver shots I have. This is how many shotgun shells I have. I've been running on 2 arrows for the longest time in this game because they're fucking not giving me any goddamn arrows. And luckily, you know, arrows oftentimes don't break when you use them. It's just like, I'm fucking using up those arrows. I have thrown so many bottles in people's faces and just yes. throw a bottle in your face, run up and hit you in the face with a baseball bat to finish you off. Like, playing on Survivor has really made me, like, pushed me to the edge on that game in a way that now I feel like I'm never going to be able to go back.
Yeah, I wound up playing it on hard again. I started on Grounded because I was really interested in it, and I couldn't get past the first combat encounter.
Yeah, I think Grounded, they do like 3 times damage or something. Survivor, they do 2 times
and they damage. Also take off all UI, so you cannot count your bullets. Like, you have to go into the menu to see it. It's hard. And I contemplated doing Survivor, but I didn't know I was going to be this engrossed in it, so I went to hard. It's still plenty fucking hard.
Oh, yeah,
hard.
Definitely.
So, like, I'm enjoying, I might still bump it up at some point to Survivor, like, midway through, just because, like, now I have my feet under me again. Because that's the other thing, is, like, it is so different than other games, like, you have to kind of relearn it when you go back to it.
Yeah, there is definitely an adjustment period.
But, like, it is, let me tell the story of my favorite one so far I've had in this run. There's a part where when you're still with Tess, and you, Tess, and Ellie are trying to get to the Capitol building early on, and you go in this part at night, and it's the part that culminates in you going through that giant, like, fallen skyscraper, which I love. But before that, you have to get past all these guards, right? And, like, they've found you, and you escaped because Ellie was badass and all that.
Yeah.
And there's a part where, and this is one of those combat encounters that is etched in my memory from, like, 2013. But you have, like, basically a long street, and there's some snipers placed there. And then there are some, like, ruined buildings on the right of that street. And that's sort of the strip you're supposed to go down, because there's cover and stuff there in those ruined buildings. But guards are coming through. And you start out behind this car. And so I went from that car, and I get into, like, the ruined building area. And there's a guard coming by. I'm like, okay, good. I'm going to take this guy out first. I take that guy out, strangle him, dump his body. And I leave it there, and then I'm kind of like, okay, there's another guy coming, and I wind up taking him out, but in taking him out, people are alerted, and now they're coming, and I have, like, no ammo, I have, like, no health, I'm really on my last legs, so I just start, when that happens, you take your brick, you shove it in someone's face, and then you start pummeling the square button, and it's just like, punch, Joel, punch, and I just beat this one guard to death while another one is coming at me. And so I beat this one guard to death, and then I take the other one, and I beat him down enough, and then I grab him, and I'm like, and when you grab someone, you can, like, do a hostage thing where you're pointing the gun at their head, and, like, I might be able to use this, because I had done this run a couple of times and not been able to get by, because there's this one part where you have to go from one ruined building to another, but there's space in there where the snipers can spot you, and I had always died there, so I'm like, okay, and I walk out with the guy, and, like, the snipers are all pointing at me, but I'm like, this, I have, like, no health, and I'm, like, limping by with this guy, and I have the gun to his head, like, and I can just imagine Joel yelling, you know, don't shoot, or I'll shoot, and they're all, like, not shooting, because I have the hostage, and right as I'm at the edge, and I can get to cover, I just pull the trigger, shoot the guy, and run, and I make it. And I try to shoot the guy, they start shooting me, and I run. It was such a gloriously cinematic, crazy, unplanned-for moment. And it really is, the more The Last of Us pushes you to the edge, the better it is.
Yeah.
It's the very rare game where you can say that. And it's why maybe I'll just go back through and play it again at some point on Survivor. Because this is a long Naughty Dog game, but it's not like a 60-hour game or anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is so satisfying and interesting to play.
And not having that listen mode, like, so just changes, because it makes having to engage with the stealth is so much more demanding when you don't have, like, your Superman, Batman power of, I can just see people through walls if I'm ducking down. Like, even then, like, the listen mode is not as, like, generous as the detective mode is in Batman, but it is, like, you know, that nice little helping hand, and you have to rely so much on natural audio cues and, like, really having to count and track. Like, I have to, like, get, like, line of sight on each individual person at the beginning of any stealth encounter if I want to be able to, like, survive at all. Because if I don't, if there are 5 people and I think there are only 3, I'm probably going to get fucked, like, halfway through this. And then that leads to the, how many revolver bullets do I have? And it's like this, I just love the mental calculus of The Last of Us, of constantly being like, what am I willing to do in this fight?
Exactly.
That's like, what do I have and how much am I willing to expend? And am I willing to use up this Molotov cocktail here or not?
And I think this is why I have to, I'm probably going to bump it up to Survivor, because now that I've got, like, my sea legs under me again, I'm good enough at the game after three plays that, like, I'm in the Pittsburgh section now, and the last section, I pretty much tore those guys apart. Mm-hmm. Not the last series. The last thing I did was the thing you were talking about with Ellie and the sniper, right. But it was before then when you're in the hotel, because I had enough shotgun ammo that I basically just tore them all apart with the shotgun, yeah. And I was like, I feel a little too much like a superhero here. I should probably bump this up.
Yeah.
So.
But thinking of how, like, every bit of resource and how, like, you're constantly counting things is really precious reminds me of something fucking stupid that happened in this. So, you know, I had just given up on Rise of the Tomb Raider, which is what led me to playing The Last of Us, which, by the way, that is such a fascinating juxtaposition because it was never more clear to me that how Rise of the Tomb Raider happened was because the Tomb Raider reboot and Last of Us came out in the same year, 2013. They made that game, they played The Last of Us, and then they made Rise of the Tomb Raider because everything new in Rise of the Tomb Raider is just from The Last of Us.
It is.
All the crap, like, all that shit. It's so much just strong pulling out from The Last of Us, to the extent that I kept on fucking up on this one little control thing, because in Rise of the Tomb Raider, if you want to make, like, whatever, like, a little, like, nail bomb out of a can, like The Last of Us, or Molotov cocktail or whatever, you equip the thing you have, and then you hold down R2, and that is how, like, you make new arrows or whatever, that's the control for it. In The Last of Us, if you want, you can either go into your backpack menu, or if you select Molotov cocktail or whatever you want out of your quick select and you don't have any, but you have the resources to make one, if you hold down X, he will make one on the fly. And in the section with Bill's Town, when you enter that part where there are like five or six clickers before you get to that gate that Bill has to unlock, which is a very difficult section, particularly on Survivor. And that's where it's like, I've died like five or six times there. Just in, like, I did one run entirely for the purpose of counting how many bricks were there, because it's like, I need to kill all these clickers, because as soon as I get out of there, if any clickers come out of that room in the next series of encounters with infected, you're basically dead on Survivor. There's almost no way to get out of that. Like, or you have to, like, use up everything you have. So I was constantly going through this encounter and counting and, like, make sure, like, I need everything. I need every brick. I need every bottle. And I have the resources to make one Molotov cocktail, which is the linchpin of my strategy for claiming that section. Because if you are smart about how you manipulate the clickers, one Molotov cocktail can take out, like, four or five clickers.
Yes, it can.
And so, but I started at the beginning of that section where my save was with zero Molotov cocktails, but the resources to make one, and I had one brick, and that brick is also critical because a brick is, can melee kill a clicker. And if you go up with a brick and you smash them in the face with that brick, you can kill them. And it's one of the few, like, sort of, like, free ways you can kill a clicker that basically costs you no permanent resources. So that brick was essential, and that Molotov cocktail was essential. The problem was, I had, like, five fucking times I did this thing where because you hit down to select the brick and hit down again to select the Molotov cocktail. And if you're playing The Last of Us, what you then do is you hold down the X button and you make the Molotov cocktail. If you have just finished playing through, or if you're, like, giving up on playing through Rise of the Tomb Raider and you're an idiot, what you do is you press R2. And if you press R2 to make craft something in Rise of the Tomb Raider, but you're actually playing The Last of Us, you then throw the brick you have in your hand at the ground with this most limp fucking throw that Joel does, just, like, aiming right at the fucking ground, and the brick shatters. And every time, I swear I did it four or five times, and everything's just, you fucking idiot, Joel, why would you do this? And I have to restart the encounter and then remember to do it, and then I die, and then I reload, and then I go, okay, time to make them all talk cocktail again. Thunk, throw the brick at the ground. Motherfucker, restart the encounter.
Yeah.
Every fucking brick is important.
It really is. The Last of Us is one of the best games of the decade.
Yeah, it's really fucking good.
We will talk about it more. I think we're going to do some kind of retrospective episode on this when we've finished it. And I'm going to bring Thomas on because I want to hear a new perspective on it.
Yes.
But Naughty Dog is really good at what they do.
Yes.
All right. Let's move on. What other stuff? What do you have any other stuff, or should I do a stuff?
You do a stuff.
You do it. I'll do a stuff. Mario plus Rabbids Donkey Kong Adventure. I'll do that.
Okay.
It's relatively recent.
Is Donkey Kong in that game?
He is. I just finished this game this morning, so it's very fresh in my memory. In my experience. This is the DLC for Mario plus Rabbids Kingdom Battle, the Switch game that came out last year that is a XCOM-esque tactical RPG with Mario characters and Rabbids.
The illicit together. Love child of Iguma and Shigeru Miyamoto.
Yes, the illicit love child. And this is the big DLC campaign for it called Donkey Kong Adventure. This was memorably advertised at E3 this year when Grant Kirkhope came out with an orchestra and played over the trailer. So the DLC is $15 on the Nintendo Switch eShop, and it is very much like the Splatoon 2 Octo expansion I reviewed over the last 2 weeks, where it is its own game within the game. Like, nice. Literally, you go into the menu on this in Mario plus Rabbids, and it says, do you want to play the main story or the Donkey Kong Adventure? You go into the Donkey Kong Adventure, it has its own save menu, its own everything. It is a set. They could sell this as a separate game. Kind of like Left Behind in the original version of The Last of Us, yeah. So it just adds it on. It's its own game. You cannot buy it on its own. Again, I think some of these DLC campaigns, they should just allow you to buy on their own, because they could be good entrees into the bigger game.
I mean, I'm sure it's because they, like, use so many files from the original game that they don't want to just, like, sell you a fucking, like, 30-gigabyte DLC that has all the original game in there.
Of course. But, yeah, anyway. And it is very meaty. It is a full new island. But this, and there were, if you don't know, Mario plus Rabbids has four islands that are the big main, like, four parts of the game, and that's where all this stuff happens. Although the island in Donkey Kong Adventure is quite a bit bigger than any of the ones in the original game, because this island has its own, like, four-part campaign, which kind of mirrors the four-part, four-island campaign of the original. It basically feels like a full sequel to the original game. It is shorter, though not by that much. It took me probably, like, 10 hours to beat this, and the original, I think, was 20, so, like, it's like a good half the length. It's not quite as full featured in that it gives you three characters, and those are the three you play as, and you cannot switch your team around.
Huh.
Because, like, it's just the way the story is set up and everything. But other than that, it is basically a full sequel. It's all new combat scenarios. The island is an all new place. If you'll remember in the original game, between every combat encounter, you would have a big section where you could go, like, do puzzles on the island and find things and explore, and that's all there. And frankly, that stuff is as good or better than it was in the original game. There's some really crazy puzzles to solve that were really hard, and the island is fucking beautiful. Like, this is a gorgeous game and runs great. It just looks amazing on the Switch. It's basically that. The story setup is that one day the Rabbids are fucking around with the laundry machine, which is also the dimensional time travel device that they use to get to the world.
As all laundry machines are.
Mm-hmm. And Rabbit Donkey Kong, who is like a big rabbit who looks kind of like Donkey Kong.
Yeah, he's in the trailer.
Yeah, he's in the trailer. He was in the original game, too. He's like a mini boss, yeah. And he's fucking with it. And when he's fucking with it, Rabid Peach, who is the vapid, like, you know, cross-dressing Rabid Peach, who, like, has a cell phone and is constantly taking selfies and stuff, stumbles into the line of fire, and she and Rabid Donkey Kong and a bunch of rabbits are teleported away, and they wind up on Donkey Kong Island. And on Donkey Kong Island, they meet Donkey Kong, and one of the rabbits is transformed into Rabid Cranky Kong. And meanwhile, Rabid Donkey Kong, the evil Donkey Kong, he has decided that he's going to take over this island, and he has taken the washing machine, and you have to go around and find all the parts to repair it, and then confront him to get back home. And that's basically the story setup. And there's not much story beyond that, but you have a lot of cute cutscenes like you do in the original game. These games are kind of what I wish the Minions movies were, because they're just, like, very funny visual skits. And I guess you wouldn't make a full movie out of that. But, like, if Minions were a series of YouTube videos that had a little more, I don't know, ingenuity to the comedy, I would enjoy them a lot. And I would...
Yeah, I mean, they come from, like, the animation tradition of, like, Tom and Jerry and that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, like, Wile E. Coyote.
And they're great in this format, because you play the game, and then you get, like, a cutscene that's, like, nice, like, 1-2 minute burst of that humor, or you might be walking around the world and get, you know, one little animation of it or something. So, like, I think the rabbits are actually really well used in this game. And in the Donkey Kong Adventure, very well used, because this one's much more rabbit-centric, even, because the only Mario character in it is Donkey Kong.
Okay.
And I will say that is probably, if I have one complaint about this game that is significant, I think it underuses the Donkey Kong aspect of the game. Like, Donkey Kong is there, and as a playable character, it's amazing what they do with him, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But as, like, a world, it's got some of the Donkey Kong music, and it's remixed very well by Mr. Grant Kirkhope, sounds good, and the world is very lush and Donkey Kong-esque, but not so much that, like, it feels like I'm walking through a Donkey Kong Country stage or something. You know, you have, like, the bananas, and it makes the Donkey Kong Country banana sound effect in lieu of coins. I like all of that. That's very good. But, like, they don't bring in any of the other Donkey Kong characters. I know that would be a lot. I feel like I'm looking a gift horse in the mouth. This is a $15 DLC, and it gives you way, way, way more than you would expect from that in most cases. But I do wish, like, there was one other Donkey Kong character, like Dixie or Diddy or someone who, like, could be another character that you could swap out. So kind of like in the original game, you could have a team with two Rabbids and a human, or a human, a Mario character, yeah, or two.
Mario is not a human.
No.
Or see our discussion about Dr. Robotnik.
Exactly. Or two Mario characters and a Rabbid. Like, that would be cool, and I think it would be neat to see what they could do with Dixie or Diddy or one of those other, like, Donkey Kong characters. But they don't, and you don't even encounter them. Like, you never see Dixie, Diddy, real Cranky Kong, any of those.
They're all on vacation.
They're all on vacation. So it's just Donkey Kong, and outside of combat, Donkey Kong doesn't do much. Like, he's at the end of the line of characters you're walking around with, because at the front is Beepo, the little, like, robot machine who you follow around. And that's how it is in the original game. But in the original game, it would be Beepo, and then Mario, and then the other characters. So you felt it was very Mario-centric. In this, it's Beepo at the front, and Cranky Kong, because he cannot walk fast, is riding on Beepo, which is very funny. But you don't, like, when you're walking around the world, the only thing that, like, firmly connects me to Donkey Kong, as a big Donkey Kong fan, is that he's riding at the end of, like, the line. But other than that, it doesn't feel so vastly Donkey Kong-esque that I get that same rush. But what you do get is basically, like I said, a more or less full-featured, like, sequel to the original game. And if you liked Mario plus Rabbids Kingdom Battle, you're gonna love this. It is more of that done very, very well. Pretty much like in the original game, every single combat encounter is creative. It is different from the other ones. It has really, like, ingenious map layout that makes you use the different mechanics in very interesting ways. It is challenging. I don't think it's as challenging as the original game in terms of, like, overall scope. Like, there are parts of it that are more challenging than, like, Worlds 1 and 2, but not as challenging as Worlds 3 and 4. It never gets, like, to that place where I really want a tactical RPG to get, which is, like, how the fuck am I ever going to beat this?
Yeah.
Like, in a fire...
You don't have, like, the existential crisis that you want to reach.
Exactly. Which, to be fair, Mario plus Rabbids totally got me to several times, even though there's no permadeath. Like, it still was like, how the fuck do I do this? Because that's the brilliance of Mario plus Rabbids. I talked about this a lot last year, because this game was even on my top 10, of, like, it is such a focused version of that tactical RPG thing, because you only have three characters, there's no permadeath, and the mechanics are much more limited, and that means it kind of opens up what you do on the actual maps so much more than in a standard tactical RPG. It's really interesting. And this one definitely has that. I don't think they push it as hard as, like, my preferences would maybe go, but that's okay. That's not a complaint. It's just, like, a personal thing. It's still very fun to play, particularly because the two new characters, Donkey Kong and, to a lesser extent, Rabbid Cranky Kong, are really fun to play with these mechanics. Like, Donkey Kong, they've really kind of reworked the basics of Mario plus Rabbids for him, where, like, a lot of Mario plus Rabbids is about movement. More than even a lot of other tactical RPGs, like, how much you can get around the map and how much you can fudge your base movement speed with different things on the map and things you can do with your teammates is a huge part of strategy in that game. And that's what Donkey Kong is all about. Because he can rip up, like, cover off the ground, or he can rip up enemies or even your allies and throw those at enemies. And that's one thing. So you can also, with your allies, you can get them further than they would normally go by having Donkey Kong throw them.
Nice.
He can carry that stuff all around the map. There are places on the map, there are DK tiles where you can go to, and those are on high points, and he can swing from vines over the map to other places. There are maps in this where you can have DK basically circumnavigate the entire map in one turn if you want him to, and you can get him all over the place, and he can do these different power moves. And it's really interesting, and I think that is one of the things that maybe makes the game a little easier in my mind, is that it opens up so many potential strategies, and he has so many powers. But they also build a lot of the combat scenarios around that, of, like, what can Donkey Kong do? Because sometimes they will throw some crazy shit at you, and, like, the par time, if you want to get, like, the highest score, is, like, do this in three turns. And I would look at that and normally say, that sounds crazy, but with Donkey Kong, I'm like, I can do that, because I can, like, there's these, like, three giant guys who have shields and I can't attack from the front, but I could take this little guy and throw him on the shield guy, and then I could move all the way across the map over to them, and then I can use his special power which is where he plays the DK Kongas from Donkey Kong Jungle Beat, yeah. And he draws in enemies to him, and when I draw in all the enemies to me, I can then use my ground pound move, which does area of effect damage all around me, and then if any are left, I could have, like, Rabid Cranky Kong, who has, like, a grenade move, send a grenade over to hurt them. It might hurt me a little bit, but I'll have taken out all the big guys. So there's, like, a bunch of calculus you can do like that. Rabid Cranky Kong has a crossbow that he uses that is pretty cool, and as I said, also a grenade move. Otherwise, he's a fairly standard character, but he is interesting. And then you have Rabid Peach, who's the same as in the original game. From a gameplay perspective, she is not the one I maybe would pick to put in this game, because there were some more fun characters I thought in the original, but she is like the scene stealer for all the story stuff, so it's nice to have her there. And as a team, the three of them like complement each other very well, which is nice, because again, you can't shift anyone out. So overall, like, there's a couple little quibbles I would have with it, like I said, but it mostly falls in the category of asking for more stuff.
Right.
And for what is there, it is super fun to play. All the combat stuff is fantastic, just as good as in the original. And the world exploration might be even better. Like, I might have to go in again and, like, because I kind of rushed through the end to finish it for the podcast. And I might have to go in and play through some of the puzzles I didn't complete and whatnot, because there was a lot of really cool stuff to explore. So if you're on the fence about this, totally get it. $15, I feel like it's nothing for something this big. It's a really nice DLC. Definitely, June was a good month for Nintendo on DLC, between this and the Splatoon 2 Octo expansion. This does not, like, expand the boundaries of the game in the way that Splatoon 2 expansion did. Like, this will probably not be on my top 10 list this year or anything, but it is more of a game I really loved, and I'm happy with that, because a full sequel would take more years.
Yeah.
So there you go. This, I feel like this is what a good DLC should be.
Yes.
It's just more of the game. I like it.
Nice.
Yeah. So that's Mario plus Rabbids Donkey Kong Adventure. It is Donkey Kong Griffic.
Never do okay. that again. Never, ever again. So another thing I've been doing. Now I'm going to talk about a mobile game, Jonathan.
Holy shit, you are surprising me so much this week, Sean.
Yes, this is actually a game I've been playing since around E3, but like not one. Kind of like with like, I'm not going to like spend an hour talking about Dynasty Warriors Gundam 3 or whatever on because I've been playing it while working out. You know, there's nothing usually to say about it. I usually don't do this with the mobile games I play. But every once in a while, I check out mobile games of like the gacha variety. Just because it's a genre that fascinates me. It's something that I saw a Twitter thread recently that kind of put this in a way that I thought was pretty interesting. I wish I could remember who did it. It might have been Rami Ismail, who's a game developer, or someone that he retweeted. But it was about these like gacha games. Instead of doing the thing that like most games are defined by, you know, their sort of core gameplay mechanics. So it's like a fighting game is defined as a fighting game because the core gameplay mechanics are it's a fighter. Or a third-person shooter is defined by it being a third-person shooter. It's not defined by it having an open world or it having microtransactions or it having, like, this larger superstructure stuff. It is, like, the core gameplay mechanic is how you understand it. And then everything else are, like, extra features that can kind of differentiate it. Gacha games are the exact opposite way of that. It is the superstructure of the, like, limited time energy and the multiple currencies and the, like, regular doling out of special events and all of that that, like, make up these gacha games that everything copies and that's how you understand it. And then all of them have a slightly different hook in terms of the gameplay mechanics. So other gacha games I played a little bit that I kind of liked were, like, Terra Battle, which was an interesting sort of turn-based game. And that's quite a bit of fun. You have the best gacha game, Love Live! School Idol Festival, which is basically, if you like the Hatsune Miku games, that's a mobile version of that. It's basically a rhythm game with like weird J-pop music. There's Fire Emblem Heroes is one that people probably like got out there a little bit more. That one's kind of interesting. Fate Grand Order is one that's kind of like a tactical, not like moving units around, but like kind of like JRPG turn-based combat. So every once in a while I jump into these. I never spend money. Never spend money on these games. That's a rule for me. That should be a rule for everybody. If you ever spend money on it, you will just ruin it for you. And you'll either spend way too much money on it, or you'll spend like $2 on it. Because I've spent like $2, I think, on Terra Battle once, and I couldn't play that game anymore because I felt stupid because I didn't get anything good for spending money. Like, these things are designed to exist on treadmills, right? And they try to seduce you into spending money. And as soon as you give them money, you either like have such a low opinion of yourself that you just keep throwing money at it. Or you have a good enough opinion of yourself that you just walk away from the game forever.
It's like paying for sex. If you do it once, you're never going to feel good about sex again.
Okay.
I can't say
that from experience, but, you know. Anyway,
I can't either.
Okay.
Hypothetically.
But after that's enough sort of preamble, the game I have been playing that is a gacha game is Dragon Ball Legends.
Is this the one that all the 7-Elevens are advertising?
I haven't been in a 7-Eleven in several years, so okay. I don't know.
There's probably one on my way to work.
Because it like just came out a couple of weeks ago, which is one of the two things that attracted me to it. The first thing was it was Dragon Ball, and the second thing was this is the only time I've ever engaged with one of these games on the ground floor. I've always come to them either years later, or it's a game that came out in Japan years ago that just came out over here, and so it might as well be a game that's been out for like 4 fucking years. This game came out, I think, literally like a month ago, which is around the time I started playing it. It has a very limited number of characters because it, you know, it just started, so they haven't built up much. And it is, if you have checked out the previous Dragon Ball gacha game, which I think was called Dokkan Battle.
That's the one 7-Eleven has.
Oh, that game is fucking terrible. That was one I played for like 10 minutes, and was like, even by the standards of this terrible mobile genre, that game is so bad that it took me a long time to be like convinced through research that was a legitimately Dragon Ball licensed video game, because it was so poorly made, I couldn't fathom the idea that like Namco Bandai and Toad, everybody like licensed out Dragon Ball to the people to make this game. It looked like it was like a fan-made project that was very poorly done. This is not that. This is much better. Like, this is probably the most fun I've had with one of these games. And one of the reasons of that is probably because since it is so new, they are just giving you shit constantly. They're just giving you the premium currency very easily. And I have almost all the characters. I think I'm, and again, having not spent any money and playing this game like 15 to 20 minutes a day, which is like the most you should probably spend a day playing one of these games, I am currently only missing 3 characters, which is Gohan, a Piccolo, and a Frieza. So one of the things I like about this game is that there are only 3 rarities for characters, which is very different. Most of these games have like 6+. So you only have Hero, which is the lowest, Extreme, and then Sparking. And so it is very easy to get access to the rare characters in the game and feel like, oh, I didn't have to play this game for like 5 hours to get one double S mega rank triple A character or whatever. You know, like the layers they put on top of these things in some of these games is ridiculous. And within playing the game and through like normal playing up and leveling your account, they basically just hand you a Super Saiyan Goku eventually, and that is a Sparking level and all that kind of stuff. So it's much more approachable. The actual gameplay is very simple but fairly satisfying in that it's real time. The game actually looks way better than any mobile game I've ever played. Like, the character models in particular look very nice. And it is this sort of real-time, like, vaguely tactical kind of thing of where you select a team of 3 characters to go into a mission. There's, like, the requisite, you know, blue character is better against red characters, better against purple character, whatever. There's, like, I think 5 different types of character based on color for a, like, vague rock, paper, scissors kind of thing. And then you charge up energy to do attacks. You have striking attacks, energy attacks. You have special skills, which each character has, like, if you use Goku and you use a special skill, you'll have, like, a buff to his special move or something. And you have your special move, which costs, like, 50 energy, which is your Kamehameha or whatever your character is. They have different ones. And so, again, the combat's very simple, but in playing the PvP, like, there is some depth there. There is some strategy. Like, it is each match is, like, a minute long at most if you, like, go through all the characters involved. And so it's fairly satisfying for what it is. The best part about the game, and the thing that would make me recommend people to check it out, and I think you should check it out for this, Jonathan, because you can just get through it so fast, is just the story for the game is so dumb, but it's so satisfying. Because so far they only have part 1, so obviously this is going to like keep on doling out. And it only covers characters up to basically the beginning of the Frieza saga. You get kind of like Zarbon and Dodoria, and that's kind of where you kind of peter out with the story, and so they're doling out characters kind of in the order they appeared in Dragon Ball Z. But anyways, the setup for the story is they make specific reference to it taking place after Dragon Ball Super. The Tournament of Power at the end of Dragon Ball Super is directly referenced by Beerus at one point. And so the setup of the story is all, like, the best warriors from all the different periods of time have been summoned to this one place. So it's, you know, the basic justification for having five different Gohans and three Krillins and a bunch of Gokus. Because it's like, here's Goku from him fighting Raditz. Here's Goku in, like, with, like, the King Kai emblem and him doing the pose fighting Vegeta. And he has, like, he's a slightly different Goku. Here's Goku that's, like, Spirit Bomb Goku that has, like, the blue, like, his orange gi ripped off. And it's just the blue undershirt, like, when he used the Spirit Bomb on Frieza. And so all of them, it's kind of, like, referencing all that stuff. But the thing that makes the story really work and is, I think, so much fun is you are sort of cast as this new original character made for the game named Shallot, who is a Saiyan that is they don't really reveal who he is because he has amnesia, because of course he has amnesia. But he's a Saiyan probably from the distant past who has been summoned here, who has no idea who he is or why he's here. But what makes it so much fun is that his character, I think all of the writing is pretty well written and is, I think, very well localized. I think maybe the localization has done more effort here and has kind of, like, spiced things up is what it feels like. I haven't seen the original Japanese text, but that's, like, the flavor I get from it. And Shallot as a character is just, like, the Saiyan id. He is so just, like, all he wants to do is fight and eat. And if you think that that's what all Goku wanted to do, you haven't seen this dude. Because, like, all of his voiced lines, like, most of the story is not voiced, but every once in a while he gets a voiced line. And then if you use his character in the combat, he has, like, he's voiced in when he wins and stuff like that. He has a couple of lines that he'll say. And everything is just, like, dialed up to 120%. He's just like, let's go fucking fight! Yeah! Obviously, it's all in Japanese. I think maybe there are English voices. I just turned on the Japanese immediately. But he's just so amped up for everything all the time. All he wants to do is fight somebody. When he's not fighting somebody, all he wants to do is eat. And the localizers have taken so much, like, life and humor to that basic premise for the character that it does really make it a lot of fun to just go through that story. It's so basic. There's no, like, drama or theme or anything to it. It is just a bunch of dumb lines to sort of, like, vaguely justify the premise of all these characters together in fighting. But there is this sort of, like, vague mystery in the background of why are all these characters assembled. One of the things I do love is that Shallot in the story is paired up with Jacko the Galactic Patrolman. And so great. That's always great. And then Bulma, but it's not Bulma from Dragon Ball Super who knows Jacko. It's Bulma from the beginning of Dragon Ball with, like, the ponytail and the blue, or and the pink shirt. And so it's, like, that, like, really young 16-year-old Bulma who, well, the only thing she wants in the world is to get the Dragon Balls to wish for a boyfriend. It's that Bulma, Jacko. Like, this, again, a Bulma who doesn't even, I think maybe has met Kid Goku, but Saiyans had not even been, like, that was not a twinkle in Toriyama's eye in the world that Bulma, this Bulma comes from. And so her having to interact with Shallot, this just insane Saiyan, and Beerus shows up, and Whis, and you know, Gohan and the other characters. It's a lot of fun. It's so dumb, but it is harmless and enjoyable, and if you don't spend any money on it, it is a very good time waster for if you have to spend 5 minutes waiting in a, like, dentist office, or on the toilet, or paying for sex if you're Jonathan. Whatever situation you find yourself in. You're the one who brought it up.
Jokes don't always go the way you think they're going
to
go.
You have to be careful in how you make your jokes.
Just like with sex,
yeah. And just like with Dragon Ball Legends, you know, if you want to pay, make sure that that's what you want to do.
Okay. I actually just downloaded the game to my phone, because it does sound very good. The premise sounds very similar to the 3DS game Dragon Ball Fusions, which is the same thing where everyone is put into the same time, and there's a bunch of crazy stuff that happens because of that. I like those. I tend to like those in the Dragon Ball video games more than just, like, let's start with Raditz and go to Boo.
Yeah.
Is where they go with a random crazy what-if story.
Yeah, I like them just sort of being like, let's just write some dumb shit for these characters and have it be funny and silly, and then justify you just being able to throw spear bombs at random people.
Yes. There's been a lot of Dragon Ball games this year.
Yes, it's a good time to be a Dragon Ball fan.
It is. It's I thought for a while, like, just getting, you know, like, I remember back in, like, the mid-2000s, like, we're getting all the DVDs. This is great. And it's like, I didn't
like,
believe
Budokai 3 is pretty good.
Yeah. One day we're going to have a whole new series and a million movies, and yeah, it's going to be crazy. Anyway, yeah, that sounds good.
Yep.
I'll check that out. I have also been playing Mario Tennis Aces.
Okay.
On the Nintendo Switch. I've had that for a little over a week now, and it has not been, like, the main thing I've been playing, because I've had all these other things going on, and it's not, like, obviously a game you would sit down and play for 3 hours, I don't right. think, the way you would a Last of Us, although some people are, I'm sure. Mario Tennis Aces is a weird game. It is really interesting, because I don't know how I feel about the overall package, but I have had a ton of fun with it every time I'm playing it. Because, like, the core tennis mechanics of the game are fantastic. They are extremely deep. They are very difficult to master. This is not, like, easy to learn, hard to master. This is hard to learn, hard to master. Okay. Like, it has way more depth to it than you would think looking at the box and being like, colorful Mario Tennis, this will be fun. And it's like, it is fun, but you also have to, like, get good at it for it to be marginally fun. And yeah, so it's got those core mechanics, and they're fantastic. And a lot of the different ways you can engage with them in the game are also really fun and fantastic. Some of them less so. Like, there are some sort of baffling omissions here that we'll get to. The story mode, they call it adventure mode. We were all kind of hoping it would be a cool, fun, like, Mario RPG with tennis. It's not. It's you go around and you do some challenges, and they're kind of bullshit, and I really have mostly ignored it. And I need to go into it and just, like, plow through it so I can unlock all the stages, but I also think the stages are kind of bullshit, and we'll get to that. But yeah, so, like, it's kind of a weird mixed package, but when you are playing it, and you're, like, playing against a friend, with a friend, online, any of that actual just, like, playing the tennis stuff, it's really, really good. I don't know if it's, like, $60 good. That's going to be up to you and how much you want to play Mario Tennis. But I have found it interesting, because I don't know the last time I paid for a Mario Sports game. Oh, actually, I do. I do. Okay. I got, this was part of a buy one, get one free deal at Best Buy. And I got The Legend of Zelda: A Link Between Worlds, and I also got Mario Golf World Tour for the 3DS.
If memory serves, I think people were lukewarm on that.
That's a good one. I like that one. It's a really good golf game. It's very fun. It's difficult but good. Like, it's very deep. It's I think people liked that one because there was the 3DS had a ton of these. It also had like Mario Tennis Superstars or something, and it had Mario Sports Superstars is where they did them all in one package and no one liked that. But they also had Mario Tennis Open. They had Mario Golf World. I don't know. It doesn't matter. But anyway, before Mario Golf, I don't know. I've rented a lot of Mario Sports games in the past.
Yes.
Like on the GameCube and the N64. But I've never really bought one. But I love the Switch. This seems interesting. I'm going to try this out. And I'm glad I have because there are some really fun things about it. The best way I've engaged with it so far is that you can play team doubles where, like, you and a friend play on one side of the court against two people on the other side of the court. And you can do that local co-op. So you can have, like, you and your friend playing on one device online against two people on a different device, which is really cool, really nice to have. And my brother and I have been playing a ton of that as, like, a couch co-op thing. And it is an insane amount of fun. You get very frustrated at each other. You bond. You fight. You make up. You win tennis, you lose tennis. You fight people who have no idea what they're doing. You fight people who have some idea what they're doing. You fight people who are clearly pros and you need to get out of this match immediately because there's literally no way you can return any serve they do because they've just completely broken down the mechanics of the game. It's that kind of thing. But it's very fun. So I like that. Like, the co-op stuff is really good. A-plus to that. And when you're also just, like, playing against someone in real life on one Switch, that's very fun. All the online stuff is actually... The online is very good. My connections have generally been very good. I had one match today where the lag was so bad I literally couldn't play and I lost. And I felt bad because it was in the tournament mode. And I had actually advanced a couple of rounds, which is pretty hard. And then I was against it was Waluigi. Just that motherfucker. That motherfucker. And it was laggy. And I was just watching Waluigi laugh. And I couldn't even move around the court.
He's probably cheating. Anybody who would use Waluigi's probably cheating.
Yeah, Waluigi's annoying. But anyway, let's talk about the mechanics. Because this is a weird tennis game. It is not like straight up tennis that is in the game. But layered on top of that is, like, people have compared it to a fighting game. And I actually do think that is a really apropos metaphor. Because, like a fighting game, there is so much to get your head around here. Like, we talked about this with, like, Dragon Ball FighterZ earlier this year, where, like, when you go online in a fighting game and you don't really understand it, you're just going to get your ass kicked so fast it's not even remotely fun. Mario Tennis can kind of be like that. And that was a weird adjustment period for me to go through. I don't think this is as hard to learn as, like, the average fighting game. It is still in the core format of tennis, which is very understandable.
Right.
And it is still a Nintendo game that's fairly approachable. But, like, So you have the main tennis stuff, and you have three kinds of serves mapped onto A, B, and Y on your controller. And those are three different kinds of serves you can do. And then X, you can do either lob the ball, or you can drop shot the ball. So, like, those are already five different moves you can do with the four face buttons. And then you have to do different directions with them on the control stick. And you can move around the court, of course. But you can also hold any of those buttons to charge up your move. And if you charge it up, it's going to go further, harder, faster, right? When you're charging up, it adds energy to your charge gauge. As your charge gauge goes up, you can do more things. Like, you can hold down the R button to slow down time as the ball is coming in, and you could get to it more efficiently. But that's really something that you're only going to use kind of as a newbie. Once you're past that, what you use the energy for is a couple of different things. There are special things you can do to get a star zone shot, where a star will show up where the ball is going. And if you get there and hold down R and hit your serve, you'll do this special thing where it goes into this, like, special zoom mode. You use the gyroscope thing to, like, move the ball to a certain place on the court, and it's going to go extra hard, and the person can try to block it, but if they don't block it right, they're going to take damage to your racket. If you get a full gauge of energy, you can do a really special version of that where you just hit L. It auto does that. You aim, you throw it, and unless they're really precise, it'll just break their racket outright. And in some forms of the game, you just win if they break their racket. In some forms, like the tournament, they have, like, two or three rackets, and you would have to break all of them to literally KO them is what comes up on screen, hence the fighting game thing. You can also use your energy to do special moves where, like, if the ball is too far away for you to get to, you can double tap X, and your character will do a special animation to jump over there in time to hit the ball. And you can do that, although you have to be very precise with it. You can go backwards, front, or side to side doing that. And I think that about explains the basic mechanics of it. But do you see what I mean? Of, like, that's more than tennis.
At no point did you say, like, backspin or lob or... Like,
I said lob.
Okay,
X,
you did.
Yeah.
Okay, yes. So it's like, so, but some of the stuff I know of having played some tennis myself in the past.
Yes. Backspin?
I don't remember slowing down time or breaking rackets.
No, but the back... I mean, backspin, I think, is B? I don't know. The A, B, and Y are like the... They're like backspin, topspin, something like that. You know, it's not so technical in that direction that I pay much attention to that. Other than lobbing and drop serves. Those are really important to get good at for online play. But yeah, like, so you have all of that. And think about, like, in an actual game, mixing all of that together and all the things you can do with it, all the things your opponent can do with it. If you're playing doubles, all the things multiplied to the power of four. There's a lot going on in this game. There's a lot to keep your head around. And when you are playing it, especially against an actual person, not a computer player, it's really exhilarating. There is so much going on. You get really into it. Even if you're getting your ass kicked, there's just kind of so much to think about while you're playing the game. It is interesting. It is the closest I've seen to a sports game and a fighting game kind of come together. And it's very strange, but it absolutely works. Those basic mechanics work.
It makes sense for tennis because tennis is... I mean, obviously you can do the two-on-two, but it's like at its core, it's a one-on-one sport, you know? So it makes sense that there would be, like, a fighting game core to it as opposed to, like, basketball or football that are so much about, like, the team effort.
Yeah, unless you, like, did football or hockey and you just had a literal fighting game in there when fights broke out, that'd be pretty
Which
fun.
That has happened. There are games that do that, yeah.
Yeah, I think that should totally be just... I think EA should start a hockey franchise where most of it is you can just, like, take off your skates and just stab people with them.
I mean, I think this Mario Tennis thing has a good idea with, like, you being able to break people's rackets, but instead of you doing that with, like, a super mega powerful shot, you should just, like, walk into the locker room before the game starts and just snap the racket. No, don't snap the racket in half. Do, like, the cartoon thing of, like, smacking it over their head and, like, the netting all breaks and it's, like, around their neck. They have, like, a big cartoon bruise around one eye.
Yeah. So it's a really interesting game. Again, like, in terms of a recommendation... Like, know what it is and know what it isn't. If you were really excited about that single-player thing, it's fine. I'm not having that much fun with it. I got to, like, the first major challenge, which is you have to kill all these piranha plants. They, like, will fire fireballs at you, and you have to hit them back in a certain way. And it's just, it's kind of, like, too demanding. And, like, it's almost like a challenge mode, but it's also sort of the tutorial mode, because that's where you go unlock stuff and learn stuff. But those two things shouldn't go together. And it's a very weird feeling. So, like, don't buy it for that. But if you want a fun game to, like, play online and sink time into, kind of like a fighting game, that sort of thing, this is probably something you would enjoy. And it definitely is a different kind of Mario Sports experience. This is not, like, resting on our laurels, let's just remake the last five sports games and dumb it down yet again, which is how the series had kind of been going for a while. This is different. This is fun. It's a really interesting game, and the online stuff is very fun. Like, the tournament mode is good. I've gotten, I think, four rounds deep into the tournament, and it's either five or six rounds. I got pretty far the other day, and I was proud of myself, and then I lost, but that's okay. And I have the whole July tournament I can try that at.
There you go.
Each month's tournament, so far at least for the next 3 months they've announced, gives you a new character too if you play in it.
Oh, cool.
So like today I played it and I got Koopa Troopa, who's a fun character to play as. He's speedy. And whenever he's moving, he's in his shell, which makes him a little unpredictable, but it is fun to play as. So yeah, the online connections, the matchmaking works great. There were problems in the pre-launch period, I know, but they did a day one patch and it's been pretty much, like I said, I had that one match with bad lag, and there's been a couple where it was having trouble finding a match for me, but we're having very inconsistent internet at my house, so that's more of a me problem than the game's problem. But yeah, I really enjoy this.
Yeah, the idea of a Nintendo game having a day one patch is like...
It is crazy.
That makes me feel like we're in the year 2018.
I know. It was like 20 megabytes. Like, right. It was tiny.
But it starts as 20 megabytes. And then eventually, you know, in Super Mario Odyssey 5 or whatever.
They have to patch in five of the different kingdoms.
Yes. Like, Mario's hat doesn't, like, load in unless you've done the day one patch.
Yes. At least this was for, like, netcode and online infrastructure.
Yeah, stuff that, like, makes sense to be patched.
That's what patches should be for.
Yes, not for, like, half the content of the game.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's an interesting game. I've also been playing a lot of Splatoon 2 still. Fucking love that game. It's, like, my go-to podcast game at the moment.
Nice.
So, yeah. Like I said, I've been playing, like, four or five games right now. And it's been fun. I'll probably put Mario and Rabbids on the shelf for a little while since I beat the DLC. I could go back and do some more, but there's a lot to play right now.
Yeah, I have already expounded the games I've played of an hour of Amazing Spider-Man 2, too much like idle time wasted playing Dragon Ball Legends. But here's one of the nice things about playing one of those mobile games is it keeps you from spending time. Instead of wasting time on Twitter, I'm wasting time on this dumb video game and making my Goku better. And I would rather get a better Goku than read bad hot takes on Twitter.
That's a good point. Yeah. It's a very good point.
Yeah, and then obviously been playing a lot of The Last of Us.
Nice. Anything else?
Here's a non-video game thing I wanted to bring up, just because I finished watching it yesterday and it, like, emotionally crushed me, but in a good way. It was the spring anime season just ended a couple of weeks ago, so if you were subscribed to Crunchyroll, a bunch of anime just finished their, like, run, and if you know me, you know I do not like to watch episode by episode. I like to just, like, binge a whole thing. And I can make a, like, if you want to be fucked up emotionally, and again, in a good, wholesome way, not in a, like, dark, fucked up way, just in a, like, oh, man, I can't believe, like, the weird emotional journey I've been on. I can make an anime recommendation. It's on Crunchyroll. It's called School Babysitter. And the premise of the show itself is so heart-crushing. It is basically the main character is a high school student, because of course it's an anime. It's a high school student named Yuichi, who has a younger brother who is much, much younger than him. His younger brother is like 3 or 4 years old, which is important, and his name is Kotaro. And right before the beginning of the series, kind of like the first episode sort of tells you this stuff as he's getting settled into his situation, his parents, and obviously Kotaro's parents, died in a plane crash right before the beginning of the series. And in that same plane crash, this woman who is the head of this sort of prestigious academy, her son and daughter-in-law also died in that plane crash. At the memorial service, she sees this teenager and this basically infant boy who can, like, barely talk, then, like, realizes, oh, they lost their parents, and she decides, I'm going to take them in on the condition that Yuichi basically runs the school daycare that takes care of all the young children of the parents at the school. And so that's sort of the setup. And the show itself is, if you just like your show, anime that is kind of funny, like it's sort of a humor show. Like, it's not like the most hilarious show you've ever seen, but like it's got a lot of humor to it.
That great genre of orphan humor, comedy.
Yes, orphan comedy, but it's like very adorable. The kids are, because there's like five or six kid characters, and it's, and they're sort of like the stars of the show in a lot of ways. Like, Yuichi's definitely the protagonist, but they're like the center of attention. They are adorable, and they can be very funny. But then there's also this sort of whole, like, life drama, school, or slice of life kind of element to it as well. But it is just like, it's very easy to get very absorbed into the show because it does have, that first episode in particular is so brutal. Just because it is this thing of, I've seen a lot of anime where the main character's parents are either dead or like gone and has like some sort of vague trauma about it. But this has like a very real core to it of like the grief that Yuichi has to go through, but then having to take care of his much, much younger brother, and then his younger brother Kotaro is this very like stoic little kid that doesn't show his emotions because he's traumatized and all that stuff. It is an incredibly adorable show, and when you're first watching it, you think it's like, oh, this is going to be very cute, and then like 5 to 10 minutes in, you realize, oh my god, this is like, it just grabs your heart and rips it the fuck out, but then it puts it back in a way that makes you feel happy and good about life, which is something you need. I think it is a good show to watch in the year 2018, where everything else is so fucked up, that a show, it like feels like it acknowledges that life is fucked up, and it's like, hey man, there's shit that is important out there too. And the last episode will probably make you cry because it is very heartwarming.
Well, that's nice.
Yes, I think that is it's a good wholesome anime.
Awesome. Well, I've exhausted my half of the outline. You've exhausted your half of the outline.
Yep.
Should we wrap this up?
Sure.
Okay. I feel like this is a weird note to end on.
Do we have any topics in the future to tease? Is anything coming out soon?
Next week is Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Okay, yes.
We're going to do that.
Yeah, Ant-Man and the Wasp.
July, we're going to be doing some different grab bag stuff. I mean, I'll say I'm moving soon. As you guys know, yeah. I'm moving to Iowa to do my PhD. So I'm very stressed out about that. And, so we're going to be having a transition. And I think we're going to do kind of behind the scenes bank up some episodes. I think August might be a little irregular, but we'll have stuff coming out. It just might not be the most current stuff. Luckily, August is not a busy movie or game month or anything. So, yeah, I mean, that's what's coming. Sean, I have the impulse.
Okay.
We've done this a couple times before. We're at the end. People can turn it off if they don't want to hear us do it.
Okay.
Let's do 10 minutes on politics.
Okay.
Because, again, turn it off if you don't want to hear it. You know what we think. But just for our own catharsis. Normally, we would turn off the podcast and talk about this one-on-one.
Okay,
let's just do it on the air this week, Sean.
Okay.
This has been the worst month of the Trump presidency, right?
Oh, uh-huh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, because it feels like the month where, like, things are happening. Like his administration is doing things or causing things or has been revealed to have been the cause of things. Whereas up till now, there has been a lot of threat of very bad things happening, but not, like, luckily there has, before this point, not been that much follow-through on it. Now there's, like, a lot of follow-through. And then there's, like, a lot of concern for the future with, obviously, the Supreme Court situation.
Yeah, I mean, there have been...
On top of it.
There have been the pockets of, like, the travel ban was awful, but got, you know, rolled back enough that, like, it's really awful, but not the worst thing in the world to the country, although it's the worst thing in the world to a lot of individual people. But that got upheld this week, so that felt like a gut punch because it brought that trauma back in.
Exactly,
you had things like, you know, banning transgender people from the military, which is cruel and horrible and awful, but feels like a very clear precursor to everything happening right now.
And it is evidence of, like, how much shit has been happening. That feels like that was, like, a decade ago.
Yeah. But this month has been the putting the children in cages... The absolute crisis that they are creating on the border. There's no actual crisis on the border. Not more than at any other time. I mean, there were actual crises that happened under Obama, for instance, like the unaccompanied children crisis that happened. There's been nothing like that, but they created this horrible thing. The Supreme Court vacancy, obviously, just the utter inanity of the takes at this point.
Uh-huh.
Because here's something, maybe this is in our realm, Sean, that I think about a lot, is has journalism been good in the Trump era with limited pockets of dumpster fire bullshit? Or has journalism been a dumpster fire with limited pockets of good?
It's definitely the latter.
I think it's
100% the latter.
That's a good question to ask, because I think, obviously, there has been so much great reporting done during the Trump era, but I think that's the exception, not the rule. I still think so, because... I guess, and call me crazy if you want, I think my standard would be if journalism was doing its job, Trump wouldn't be president, and we wouldn't stand for this. Like, there wouldn't be any question. There would be no being like, the president today locked up children in cages. One side says this. No, it would be, Jesus fucking Christ, headline on the New York Times, the president is putting kids in cages, right? Yeah.
You like, know, like,
that would be good journalism.
Yeah, it is something of where it just feels like our mass media was so, not like just like, I was going to say they're like poorly equipped, but like not so poorly equipped to deal with Trump. It is in the situation of, I mean, if we didn't have this situation, Trump wouldn't be our president. One, because if we had like a properly functioning media and like journalistic media, you know, the controversy surrounding Trump would have had teeth to them,
yes,
and stuck more. But then the other thing is that like the specter of Trump was created by the media attention that he had, and the,
yeah,
fact that our media did not latch into the real issues around Trump, like before the election and then obviously after the election, enough to make enough of a dent into the larger sort of like Trump base, which like, and like the media could. That is not impossible. It's like, it's not every day that an insane dictator rises up to be the president of the United States. That's not a common occurrence. It's like they're, but like, people who would become crazy dictators are always running for politics, constantly. But they need the situation to be able to rise up to get to the top, right? And the,
yeah,
media has like helped create that. And that's one of the sort of vacuums they opened up that sort of like boost him up there.
When Michelle Wolf did the White House Correspondents' Dinner last month, everyone in the media got up in arms about her things about Sarah Sanders, right?
Uh-huh.
But here's what I think they were actually mad about, is there was a much less publicized part at the end of her monologue, which was fucking brilliant, by the way.
Yeah.
But at the end of her monologue, she said, and you guys are Trump's biggest fans. You can't stop talking about him, you can't stop writing about him, and you all know you're very scared of what would happen if he wasn't here. Because it's a very symbiotic relationship. And I think that's the thing that pits the people,
yeah,
off in the room. I don't think it was actually the Sarah Sanders thing. And what she said is a very direct thing that not enough people are saying, which is that, like, you know, we're all annoyed when the New York Times publishes its 500th think piece on what is the white racist, is the white racist Trump voter still white racist and a Trump voter? Yes.
Yeah.
And they do it over and over and over again and can't pay any ink to, like, the people in the district where Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez just won this,
yeah,
week, right? And can't go interview those people who might actually have interesting things to say. But what we don't say about that is, like, what annoys us about it is it's not just an ideological thing. It's a business thing. It's like, they're going to do that because that's the business they're in, and it's a really gross part of the business. And it's like these competing things where we know journalism is a business, and it is a gross capitalistic business, but we also want it to be this ideal public service good. And I feel like one of those is winning out way more than the other.
In the same way that it is in most of those sectors, like it,
yes,
is in healthcare, that is also like the ideal version that like people who support, you know, capitalist sort of a capitalist healthcare system, which is like a weird phrase, but it is what we have.
It's a fucking oxymoron.
Yeah, but like it is the way that it is pitched that is supposed to work is that like you have all the good whatever like competitive stuff of capitalism that like creates better medicine or like whatever, you know, pushes the industry forward, but still, you know, enough of sort of altruism to it that it functions as a public good. And that balance, like, healthcare is, like, one where that balance, I think, in no way can possibly exist because it just doesn't make sense. In journalism, there's maybe a bit more of a wiggle room there in healthcare, but still, like, it is, like, capitalism and the public good are not usually in lockstep. They have not been historically.
But to get back on the point, like, why I brought up the journalism thing is that the last couple weeks have been the most frustrating symbol of, like, the double step going on here, where like the migrant crisis, the locking up the children, and then the reversal that really wasn't a reversal because nothing has changed,
yeah,
and we have kidnapped 3,000 children that were not returned to their parents, which is a permanent stain on the United States of America that our,
yeah,
children will be reading about like we read about Japanese internment. I,
yeah,
mean, period. That's what this will be. But like, there was that grew into the public consciousness because a lot of journalists did a lot of really good work getting into those centers, getting that material. It was the ProPublica tape of the children in the center crying that really got this into the public consciousness. And so that's an example of journalism exactly doing its job because it got this to the forefront, and it,
yeah,
is an important story that Americans need to know about. But like as soon as all the major outlets could change that story, they did. And it was when stupid fucking Sarah Huckabee Sanders goes into that restaurant, and someone refuses to serve her. Now we've had a full fucking week of people talking about, is civility in danger? Are Democrats being civil enough in fighting baby Hitler? Are we? It's like, yeah. And that's what I mean, is that like there is this absurd doublespeak to all of this of like, that's not even a question worth asking. Like, one restaurant decided not to serve one, you know, dumpy Goebbels, and it's like, all we can do is talk about, like, are they being civil enough? And no paper was publishing, except in maybe some opinion sections in some more left-leaning publications, like, but wait a second, is it civil to lock children up? You know?
Yeah, like...
And it's so ludicrous.
The civility debate, whatever that means, you know, it's so not worth having. And that it, for it to be able to supplant, effectively, in terms of, like, what is the what is getting the most coverage at that moment,
yes,
the ongoing crisis relating to immigrant children at the border, is, you know, it's so absurd that it should be something that's in, like, Dr. Strangelove, right?
Yes.
It's something that should be in a comedy, the idea that people having this argument about what is civility in political discourse when that's not, like... How is that even a part of this conversation? Like, how does that even come up?
We're in a profound crisis from which the United States might never recover. Like,
yeah.
Period. Like, that's where we are. It could. It's up to all of us. But if the conversation is, are we being civil enough in attacking this existential threat to our nation?
It's like, it's the most Victorian bullshit that the Victorians didn't really quite do. I mean, yeah, like, they had that version of that. But, like, this is so far that it is just like a... What? Like, what do you think civility and manners are? Like, where do you think that, like, the root of that should be? Because it is very much, I mean, this is something that happened during the civil rights movement of people being like, you shouldn't protest. That's not the civil, like, you shouldn't have violent protests or, like, protests that inconvenience anybody in any way. That's not the proper civil polite way to hold a protest. Because the proper civil polite way to hold a protest or any sort of political movement is, of course, where nobody can see you so you can't affect any change.
Exactly.
Like, that's what they want.
That's exactly what they want. I mean, and that's what infuriates me, is that literally every newspaper in the country and every news network basically just published Trump propaganda on this, because that's what the Trump team wants us talking about, because that is their territory. And we get onto their territory so easily. And this is why I feel so helpless in a week like this, is that even Democratic leaders can't do this right. Like, uh-huh, this, it should be such an easy layup for your base, for your voters, for independent, for whoever you're trying to attract, to say, you know what, maybe I might not have kicked them out of my restaurant, but I respect that person's right to do so, because, and then you just politically, you do the political speak of, you get it back into, here's what my opponent is doing that is horrible, and we need to fix that. And they didn't do that. Some of them did that. But all Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi could talk about for several days was that Maxine Waters shouldn't have said that thing about, we should protest Trump people. And it's the stupidest thing on earth, because all you're doing there is depressing your base and getting the Trump people rabid at the mouth. And you're not helping anybody's cause, except theirs.
Yeah.
And all of that stuff, and especially in a week where we had the Kennedy retirement, which was a real gut punch.
Yeah.
Because nothing good can come from that. Nothing good. And, you know, it's... There's a point where, you know, I think people in this country are activated and are fighting very, very hard. We had the marches today, yesterday morning, sorry, Saturday morning, for, against the child immigration policy that's so horrendous. And I sadly could not attend that because I was heading to work that morning. But, you know, it was very inspiring to see, and I think that's great. I do think Democratic leaders, if there's not a time to step it up, if this is not the time to step it up, there's never going to be a time to step it up. You know, if we can't fight against children being put in cages as hard as Republicans fought against Obama being black, which is all they had for 8 years against him, if we can't do that, we're fucked. We are true and wellly fucked. And we either those people have to step up to the plate or they have to be replaced. So that's just the point I'm at, where it's like, that's the part that feels somewhat hopeless to me. And some people are, and you know, most of, I think, the Democrats in Congress are pretty good about this. You know, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi are part of an old guard, and if you look to the new guard people, they're so much better on this. You know, I I'm a big fan of like Kirsten Gillibrand, and she's like the first sitting senator this week to call for the abolishment of ICE, which I think is a good idea, because it's, I don't think having a police state organization that was formed 15 years ago and has gone completely amok with power is a good thing. But yeah, that's me.
Yeah, no, it is like, it is in some ways maybe the most disconcerting part of it is feeling like there is no figurehead to get behind on the opposite side. There is no, you know, there is no Godzilla to Trump's Mechagodzilla, to use a weird metaphor. You know, like, there's nobody else, there's no one to step up to that plate, it feels like, yet. Like, there are, you know, there are people, like, kind of, like, baking in the oven, like, maybe eventually to get to that spot. But it's hard to feel like there's some really strong figure, like what Obama was in 2008, to be able to rally behind. There's nobody that has that quality to them yet.
In some ways, that's a good thing. That means we have to rebuild, and we are rebuilding organically. You know, it's, I think I'm happier that we don't have an obvious heir apparent, because the last time we had that, it really didn't work out. Because I like and respect Hillary Clinton an awful lot, but I don't think there's any way you can postmortem the 2016 election and say that was the right choice. You know, because it was a weird position where I think Trump was the only Republican she could have beat, and she was the only Democrat Trump could have beat. Uh-huh. So, of that field. So it was a weird, very weird scenario to go back and think about. But yeah, I don't know. I you know, the 2018 election, it scares me. It keeps me up at night. This is the most important election of our lifetimes. Because I think it's this is it. Either we get one of the two chambers of Congress back and we can do something, or, you know, the election's November 6th and on November 7th, they're going to go crazy because they will have zero checks until the 2020 election. And if they have another 2 years of no checks, there's no way we win in 2020. Mm-hmm. And then it's, that's it. I mean, they could, I'm really scared about that, you know? And I'm going out to Iowa, and that's obviously a very politically active state, and I'm interested to try to get active in that a little more, because I've lived in a pretty safe Democratic county most of my life.
Uh-huh.
Not a ton that can be done here. But yeah, there was the one inspiring thing was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is the coolest fucking politician we've met this year.
Yeah.
28-year-old Puerto Rican, millennial politician. We need more. I think everyone over 55 should be kicked the fuck out of Congress and replaced with someone under 30, we'd get a lot of shit done.
Yeah.
I like that. That was inspiring. That was one, like, thing to grasp onto.
It does, yeah. And that's, like, kind of the thing I was just saying of there's, like, nobody there yet, because it does feel like
they're coming.
They're coming, but, like, if there's anybody, like, ready to, in that position, like they would have been a politician for, like, 20 years and we'd know. Like, I feel like you'd feel it in some way.
But I don't think a 20-year politician is the answer right now.
No, but it's know. Also, yeah, it's, I don't know if you can elect somebody who's 30 years old, you know.
No, and I don't mean her for president, but I think a changing face to the party and someone who can pick up that figurehead. But that's a 2020 problem. It's a, I don't know, we're punditizing now.
Yeah.
So I just, the point was, I wanted to vent a little bit about this. The world is shit.
Yep.
You know.
Yep.
We called for donations last week or 2 weeks ago when the child migrant crisis started. I don't even, there's so many places you could direct your money right now. You know, any organization that deals with women's reproductive health and freedom would be a really good choice at the moment, since Roe v. Wade is very, very much in danger, and that is horrific. It truly is. But yeah, that would be a good choice. The ACLU keeps winning lawsuits. That's a good one, you know. But yeah, the world sucks right now. It really sucks.
It definitely does.
I think we can make it better. I hope we can. I hope, you know, we cheer you up a little bit each week with our stupid, silly podcast.
Yep.
That's not much, but it's something. I don't know. If you've made it to the end, you're a super fan. You get a gold star. We'll be back next week. We're going to talk about Ant-Man. It's silly. That's
something to look forward to. A sequel to Ant-Man, which is like the most fun movie ever.
Yes.
You know, it's the most just fun Marvel movie. There's no big stakes. Nothing terrible happens. It's just like, let's goof around with Paul Rudd. He's very likable.
Everyone likes President Paul Rudd. Paul Rudd 2020.
Yes, Paul Rudd and Evangeline Lilly. Like, that's a combination I can get behind.